We're joined by Attorney General Lockyer from California. Now, Bill, I want to thank you for bringing the nice weather with you. It certainly, we've had a rough winter, but I don't think you want to talk about the winter either in terms of what's happening out there. Speaking of the weather, there is no air conditioning in this room. The windows are open. Obviously, there'll be some outside noise, but please feel free to take off your coats, and certainly we'll make the best of it. We're also joined by a number of attorneys general from throughout the country. Our president, Carl Stovall from Kansas, you honor Tom Miller from Iowa, Elliot Spitzer from New York, and several others. You honor us with your presence. There will be a number arriving during the course of the day. My special thanks to Eric Saltzman, who is the executive director of the Berkman Center, in terms of hosting this conference. We're very proud, obviously, of our academic institutions in this area, not just Harvard, but MIT, but a whole range of them, as we are proud of the leading companies and internet companies in our state who have made Massachusetts their home. I want to thank Christine Milliken and Lynn Ross and the staff of NAC. What you've done is very impressive. As you'll see throughout the course of the next few days, we have an extremely talented and diverse group, not just from law enforcement, from the academic community, but representatives of the business community, as well as members of the media. It is a wonderful and a very unique opportunity for all of us to listen to each other and learn from one another and begin the process of, or continue the process of addressing some very serious issues. It's an exciting time for the internet and for technology, and I think the potential is just unlimited. But the dangers are real as well. And that's why, speaking for Massachusetts, we are absolutely delighted that privacy issues are the highlight of this conference. Both here in Massachusetts and throughout this country, attorneys general have had a historic obligation to protect consumers and protect individual rights. And there are few rights that are more important than maybe one of ours. Important rights and individual rights to privacy. I think it was said best by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. He termed it the right to be let alone, and that's what at stake here. There is absolutely no question that we have a long way to go in terms of making sure that our personal zones of privacy are protected. And quite frankly, the laws simply have not kept up with the rapid and tremendous advancements in technology. And that's what I believe is what the next few days is all about. We need to find the balance in terms of making sure that privacy rights are protected, while at the same time to assure that both the internet and technology can grow and prosper and reach their full potential. Now, obviously, these are complex issues, and they're not easy. I don't think anyone in this room has all the answers. But I do, and I certainly don't, but I do know where to start. And the start is the process of listening to each other and learning from one another. So we've got an exciting few days ahead of it. It's just a tremendous agenda. So let's sit back and enjoy it. And again, welcome Attorney General Bill Lockyer from California.
Well, I want to echo Tom's welcome to this conference. We hope that it will be thought-provoking and worthwhile. There's been a lot of activity during the last year of those of us associated with e-commerce, internet, and privacy issues, principally to summarize any of those developments, I would say principally we had a very robust internal discussion that involved privacy advocates around the country, as well as business and commerce leaders and being members of our own association and staff. That resulted in the production of a set of principles that many of us at least have subscribed to with respect to the issue. That was Chris Gregoire's subcommittee that generated those. She regrets not being with us today. State employees in Washington State decided to have a labor dispute, and they're on strike. So she's at home tending to some of the legal issues associated with that. But the debates are interesting. We, I think, all have a feeling that there's some sense, at least, that leads us to believe that the trends in law and technology that we'll be talking about today and tomorrow are at the heart of an understanding of the evolution of our economy and changes in our responsibilities as law enforcement officers and public leaders. I wanted to start right away with the panel discussion and let them begin to reflect on these issues with you. We have three extraordinary panelists, and their biographical vitas are in the materials. If you want to read a little more detail of either their writings or personal histories, Jonathan Zittrain has been kind of a anchor and partner with us in the Bergman Center. Has been an extraordinarily great assistant in making all of these arrangements, the conference materials and speakers, and then similarly when we started this process last year in Stanford, they were able to reach out and even help us there. Jonathan is a professor of law at the law school here and co-director, faculty co-director of the Bergman Center for Internet and Society. Let me, while I do this, let each tell you just a speck about each one. Hiawatha Bray, next to him, well, that's all that academic stuff in your book, you know, but an economist and a communications fellow who's many of you have seen in other parts of the country as a journalist, Chicago, Lexington, Detroit, and of course in the last several years at the Boston Globe. He's won many, many awards for the quality of his commentaries and writing. John Gage, who's chief researcher and the director of the science office at Sun Microsystems, has just gotten off a plane from Beijing. He told me that he had offered to swap himself for the plane, but they didn't take him up on it. John and I have known each other for more than 30 years since we were students together at Berkeley, and it's been really fun to watch him grow from sort of commercial responsibilities in this large company to reach out and affect the development of internet policy globally. He, among other things, is the one held most responsible for the NetDay events of 1995 and subsequently, where you saw Bill Clinton and lots of other people out wiring high schools to try to contemporize our systems of learning and educational facilities. So those are the three. I thought my job really is, at least initially, to pop the cork and let them each comment and reflect on trends in technology and the law, and then we'll hope for some interaction and some participation from any of you that may have questions or concerns that you wish for them to address. So are you going to sit or stand? How do you prefer to do it?
I think I'll stand because okay. I brought slides.
Sure. Jonathan Zittrain first.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I came all the way from Harvard Square, and just sort of stretching out now, yes. It's so great to have you all here, having been out on the West Coast last year for this. Larry Lessig is fond of dividing the nation into East Coast Code and West Coast Code, with East Coast Code being sort of U.S. code or other state codes that pour out of legislatures, and West Coast code being technology code pouring out of the hands of programmers. As you'll see, out in the East, we also have the other kind of code. We're not just about East Coast code here on the East Coast. Also pleased to be here with Tom Riley. He's been so on top of these issues, as you can tell even from his introduction, and on the cutting edge, and I'm delighted we're able to share that. The title for our panel today, such as it is the ubiquitous Internet, and I abbreviated that to the ubiquitous net. I did bring slides. I figured it'd be nice to have something to look at this early in the morning, but I promise you, as I just promised Hiawatha, there are no bullet points on the slides. There's not a single bullet point. It's mostly visual aids of various kinds. So this is about the ubiquitous Internet. And when I think of ubiquity, I think of, you know, something is everywhere. And indeed, I'm pretty convinced that pretty soon the Internet will be everywhere. And once it is everywhere, it won't make much sense to have conferences about it. It'd be like talking about, you know, I teach a course on Internet and society. It'd be like a course on electricity in society. Or even, you know, having a conference about electricity. Who would possibly do... Attorney General Walker, I'm very sorry for bringing up a sore point there. I guess you get my general drift, aside from the electricity point. So when I was presenting last year, I presented three bubbles of this sort. And here were the three bubbles I said that I gathered that the attorneys general were generally concerned with as they tried to relate to Internet issues. One bubble was law enforcement, how the cyber world relates to that, either by way of assistance or challenge. The other is consumer protection and privacy. That's another big issue. Again, Attorney General Riley just highlighted that. And the third is competition. Competition, of course, at the time was the Microsoft case, which we know is still in high gear, just sort of spinning around in high gear, but in high gear nonetheless, and we're eagerly awaiting what the D.C. Circuit will do on that front. So I thought what I would do is sort of try to give you a snapshot. What we call this in technical terms, it's an incremental backup. Instead of backing up everything, repeating everything that was gone over last year, I'll do the increment. What changed between last year and this year, as near as I can tell, and with it I'll try to share some of my current research in these areas. So I thought first I would talk about the law enforcement area, and substitute for that, and this is obviously not meant to cover all the law enforcement issues, but I figure I would talk a little bit about Napster. That was certainly in the headlines last year, and it remains in the headlines. And I wanted to just try to review the bidding on exactly where we are with Napster, put it into a bit of a theoretical framework, and very quickly tell you where I figure it's going to go next. So to begin my brief review, I start with AD 1400 here. So I start somewhat early. This is the era of the monastic manuscript. This is a time in which it was very difficult to copy stuff. You had to hire a scribe, you'd actually have to pen out the thing, and his error rate was generally quite high, so you'd have to have another scribe look over what the scribe did, and the music just didn't sound the same when you listened to a copied, well, when you held up to the light, a copied piano concerto of some kind. I guess this was even before the piano, but you get my drift. It was very hard to have free-flowing intellectual property, and as a result, you didn't even need intellectual property as a legal category. The law didn't need to protect anything because the technology or absence of technology did the job all by itself. As a result, I've placed this orange blob, which I take to be the range of plausible behavior in which people can engage, I've placed it more to the right on this chart, towards more constraint rather than less constraint. And as you'll see, as we fast forward, for instance, into the era of the Gutenberg press, the blob expands leftward. And why is that? Because now we have printing presses with some amount of fixed effort. You can now crank off the stuff like those purple mimeograph machines that used to be in vogue about 15 years ago. And the smell might not be so good, but you would get pretty good, reliable copies once you'd gone to the trouble of making the original template. And as a result, the range of plausible behavior in which people could engage as far as copying goes was expanded leftward, and perhaps some would say too far to the left, because those who generate intellectual property want to get paid for it. And if they just generate one copy and then everybody else copies it without having to come back to the source, it may be hard to recoup one's investment. And as a result, we see in this era the beginnings of a legal boundary being drawn, saying, I understand that it's not that hard for you to make a copy, but we're going to ask law to tell you that you're not allowed. We're simply going to stop you from doing it because we think that there's some other social values at stake, such as letting authors recoup for their works. So this then advances us far ahead. I even think the Xerox machine was captured by the blob we just saw. But now we see that orange blob expands even farther leftward in AD 1994, as we get into what you might call the era of promiscuous publication. And this is where, thanks to the internet, you can zap this stuff around and you don't even have the mimeograph smell hanging in the air as you copy something perfectly, costlessly, and instantly. Three great things that are also meaning trouble. And I just snipped from the Time a couple articles that capture the idea. It's from the Christian Science Monitor from 1994. It says, it's a thought that strikes terror in the hearts of entrepreneurs. What if their visions of online commerce turn out to be a mirage? What if all the information they hope to sell on the so-called information highway is free? Now, it's interesting that that was the worry in 94 because we went through the whole mania of 98 to 2000 thinking free is great. We'll just sell, or as it turns out, swap with other dot-coms, banner ads, and somehow that's going to pay for everything. But it sounds actually somewhat prescient now in retrospect. As the 94 people say, the threat is real enough that publishers, technologists, and legal scholars will begin a raucous debate about protecting copyrights in cyberspace. Here from 95 is that sort of colloquial description transformed into a law review article. Telecommunications footnote and the information superhighway footnote facilitate instantaneous mobility of literary and artistic works in the form of text, video, and audio recordings footnote. You get the idea. With a click of a mouse or a tap of a key, anyone with a computer and telephone can obtain vast quantities of information from almost anywhere on the globe. These conditions pose a formidable challenge to the international protection of intellectual property. You know, what a downer. Here I thought this article was going to be like, wow, the internet is great, and instead it talks about the formidable challenge posed. Note that I did copy the star paging. If there is anybody from Westlaw here, you can handcuff me after the presentation for copyright infringement. So, here's another clip from 94. This is good old John Perry Barlow, whom I'm sure you've heard of in some kinds. This is how he puts it lyrically, rather than just reporting the news or having all the footnotes in the law review article. Legal efforts to keep the old boat floating are taking three forms: a frenzy of deck chair rearrangement, stern warnings to the passengers that if she goes down, they'll face harsh criminal penalties, and serene, glassy-eyed denial. IP law cannot be patched, retrofitted, or expanded to contain digitized expression any more than real estate law might be revised to cover the allocation of broadcasting spectrum. It's not clear to me that that isn't exactly what's happened with broadcasting spectrum, but he says we need to develop an entirely new set of methods as befits this entirely new set of circumstances. Here's a review of Barlow from one of the lawyers in Lawyers Weekly. He says, since I read a column on IP, my attention was naturally caught by the words, "Everything you know about IP is wrong," on the cover of Wired. Full title of the article is The Economy of Ideas by John Perry Barlow, who is, according to a short blurb, a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. The thesis of the article, as far as I can make out, is that copyright and patent laws are outmoded because they're based on physical embodiments of ideas, meaningless in the age of high tech. In the end, I concluded only that Mr. Barlow must have consumed more than his share of prohibited substances while writing all those Grateful Dead lyrics. So you have the legal establishment responding with some measure of skepticism to Barlow's claim that it's all over, that orange blob has gone so far leftward that any hyphenated red line that you try to interpose to stop people from behaving within that leftmost portion of the orange blob isn't possible. And sure enough, there have been attempts since 94 to make that orange, vertical red line a lot thicker. Right, we've seen the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the No Electronic Theft Act, things like that, and Hiawatha has actually been great at documenting this process by which we've seen law race in to try to hold the hordes rightward on my chart with limited success. Now, I gather in most audiences, at least I've only tried this out in my Internet and Society class, I've asked an audience like this, how many of you have used Napster? Last year, everybody raised a hand. About half of them had used Nutella. Some of them were using it at that very instant in the classroom. I don't know if I should try the same thing here. Are we covered by mutual attorney-client privilege? How many people here have actually used Napster? This is the most law-abiding group of citizens I've seen, and I suppose given our composition, I'm very happy to see it. If I asked how many of your kids have used Napster, what would they? All right, that's a somewhat higher percentage. The rest? You need to sit down with your kids and have a serious conversation about how to abide by the law. So we've seen attempts to thicken the line. No teenagers have yet been thrown in jail as a result, even though what they're committing, even under the federal codes now, are felonies by and large. But the overriding sense so far as we watch the Napster case is still that of the barbarians are at the gate and about to bash it down if they haven't already. There's this sense of futility that's still well echoed by Barlow's 1994 thinking. Now, my guess is that in the great game of poker, that is represented by Napster versus the recording industry versus the anarchist hordes that want to use the stuff, I think the record industry is actually still holding a number of good cards. Excuse me, let me grab a little bit of water. They're still holding a number of good cards, and that's so even as the legal boundary, I think, has largely reached its limit, at least in the traditional form of, if we catch you doing this, you go to jail. And here's how my guess is that we're going to be able to push this rightward, actually use the technology, some West Coast code, to eliminate some of that orange blob. And to help answer that question, I want to harken back to a slide that I showed you exactly a year ago. As you'll recall, when we were at Stanford, it was the day by which the media mega merger was announced. Here it is from Tuesday, January 11th, 2000. That was when we were at Stanford enjoying the Stanford winter. And Time Warner, AOL come together, and I used it at the time to talk a little bit about competition, as you'll recall. I won't use it for that purpose now. Instead, I'm going to use it for the purpose of saying that at some point, Time Warner, which is a content production company as much as it is anything else, is going to realize that within the Time Warner octopus, there are a few tentacles that have to do with content provision, but also tentacles that have to do with simply moving bits around. Internet service providers, a number of people at their houses get their high-speed internet access from Time Warner cable. They have a Time Warner cable modem. Now, my guess is that it won't be too long before, and it's already happening a little bit, you can tweak the Time Warner provision of internet service so that maybe you won't clamp down on Napster downloads. After all, that's why people often get a cable modem, so that their Napster can work better. You don't want to crimp that kind of sale. But maybe you could stop uploads. You could stop people from sharing the songs that they download. They can maybe still download it themselves, but the whole idea behind peer-to-peer, a phrase that is meant to strike fear, peer-to-fear, into the content-providing people, is it relies on each individual computer on a network being able to give pretty much as good as it gets. It's got to be able to ship data out as quickly as it is receiving it. And my guess is that given that people are getting high-speed internet access from companies that also have reason to want to cooperate even internally with those who worry about protecting intellectual property, there may be ways by which, as it is even right now in Harvard Square on my high-speed internet connection, I find that my upload is a lot slower than my download. That's true even on the Harvard campus if you're in a Harvard dorm. Metallica sent a nasty letter, it looked like a template form letter, but they sent a nasty letter to the president of Harvard University saying that people on campus were stealing Metallica tunes, and what was Harvard going to do about it? And with one hand, Harvard said, I'm sorry, but we aren't going to do anything. We don't believe we have any responsibility here. It's just too early to tell. On the other hand, simultaneously, the Harvard network people announced that due to bandwidth limitations, they were clamping all uploads out of the student computer network. And as a result, any student using Napster here or even Nutella finds it quite difficult to share his or her music with the rest of the world. So I think there are still some tricks up the sleeves of the record industry working in tandem with the internet service providers, and at some point you may see, if there isn't cooperation with a handshake, an attempt to interpose some form of liability through the law, say the DMCA, you can say to Time Warner Cable, wait a minute, we know there's a particular person using your service that is infringing copyright. You need to take down their internet connection. No more internet for them unless they clean up their act. So I think there are still a few things left in the arsenal, and indeed we might be able to push this orange blob all the way back to the right, almost towards the era of the monastic manuscript. So you can't even copy stuff as easily as you could if you had it in your hands and could get it near a Xerox machine. Just a couple quick examples of that. Here is Stephen King's Riding the Bullet, his first e-book venture from I think a year and a half ago. This thing, if you tried to print it out, it would refuse to print. If you tried to send a copy to a friend, it would say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You actually had to read the thing on your computer, and you would click the next page button, and you hear a simulated page turn. It would go as you read it. You feel a little bit foolish, and then after a while, you really want to finish the novella, so you just put up with it and finish reading it on your machine anyway. Now, it's true. Hackers hacked this thing, even though the price ultimately was zero. They were giving it away, even though you couldn't give away the copy you were given. Hackers still hacked it just for fun. But I think it's entirely possible that this is part of our future. I showed you this slide last year, the Trusted Computing Platform Alliance. This was Intel, IBM, Microsoft, Compaq, and HP. I don't know if Sun is a member of this alliance. My guess is they are, the purpose of which is to have these hardware and software manufacturers come together to start putting things like riding the bullet, not just in software, but into the very hardware you buy. So it's a lot harder to hack. You need a soldering iron rather than a floppy disk in order to figure out how to crack the code. Here is, of course, their updated homepage. You'll see that they've updated spec version 1.0 of the platform, and most of the areas are still under lock and key, so that you can't exactly see what they're up to unless you're a member of the alliance. Now, you might remember this from last year, too. This was my sense of the emerging order, such as it is on the internet. What I'm focusing on is at the very top here. You plug a computer into this mess at the bottom, which is the internet as we know it right now, and the computer works. My guess is we're going to evolve from the computer on top to something like what you see on the bottom. What you see on the bottom is the Philips TiVo. Now, TiVo's stock price was not immune from the internet bust. It's gone from about 45 down to 4 right now, perhaps a good time to buy. But the TiVo is just basically a big hard drive inside a very attractive chassis. You plug that into your cable feed, and TiVo starts taping stuff like crazy. And you can tell it to tape various programs, and when you come home, you ask it, what is now showing? And there's a whole menu of stuff for you to watch. Of course, if you wanted to copy the stuff onto your hard drive, even though it's inside a hard drive on the TiVo, there's no easy way to do so. It's a Linux box underneath, but your only way in is through a very nice-looking remote control for which there's no button that says, copy this to my hard drive. Indeed, into the TiVo, they've built the feature observed in the New York Times Magazine such that you can't do a 30-second skip because NBC owns a portion of TiVo, and you don't want to ace out the commercials that easily. So instead, there's this sort of awkward fast-forward thing that still subjects you to the Alpo ad, and you sort of want to stop and see what's up before you move to the rest of your program. My guess is we're going to see a lot more appliances like this hooked up to the internet, platforms that are trusted to be used only for certain purposes, for which it's a lot harder than with the general purpose PC to hijack them for your own purposes. Okay, last piece of what I wanted to put out today, and that is moving away from what I've been calling roughly the law enforcement circle, looking over towards privacy and competition. And this I really want to put out as a genuine question to you all. I'm curious for your reaction. Here is my hypothetical screen of allmuzak.com. It might look suspiciously like another online e-tailer. And here is one person visiting on the left. And that person has asked for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There it is, quoting the price. I tried to be international about it in Swiss francs. It's 22 Swiss francs. And there's a particular URL that represents that page. Now, you could send that URL to a friend. Hey, I'm thinking of buying Sgt. Pepper. What do you think? And if they visit the URL, you figure they'll get that page, too. Of course, there's no reason necessarily to think that. Here's somebody else visiting the exact same link, and you'll notice that Robert here is quoted 12 francs, whereas Jeff is quoted 22. It's the exact same product to different people for which different prices are quoted. Now, why would you possibly want to do that? Well, you may have reason to believe, thanks to data you have gathered from Robert, either thanks to Clickstream data, he appears to be a very timid shopper. He's kind of like a doe in the woods. He creeps up to the product, he sniffs it, he walks away. A week later, he comes back. Finally, he can be induced to purchase. This is somebody for which you need to sweeten the pot as much as possible. Jeff, on the other hand, as evinced by his online behavior, is one of those one-clickers. And he just goes on, sees the album, clicks to buy it, and on to the next one. And in that instance, you might as well flash off a higher price because he seems to be price-resistant anyway. This is sort of what they do on a car lot, except without a lot of the consultations with the manager and hassle that come with actually having to try to buy a car. Now, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not sure it's a bad thing. But you can imagine all sorts of ways of starting to divide between people such that there's no static price anymore for any product at this website. The prices are always tailored just for you. And whether that makes you feel good or bad may depend on how you feel about the condition of your wallet and the habits by which you shop. Now, I can make it a little less glaring. Here they're both offered 22 francs for the item, but then they click for their special frequent visitor discount, and it amounts to basically the same differential. Now, somehow intuitively, that doesn't seem as bad as getting quoted the initial price right up at the base as different, but I'm not sure what the actual difference is between them. One thing I suppose you might demand is what I call the sucker meter. If you are quoted a price and other are quoted different prices, maybe you need to be shown with a little wedge where you stand. So the person on the left is on the right of the price range disclosure meter. Somebody out in the world is getting it for $10.29, just not you, and the person on the right is on the blue happy side of the price discrimination, price disclosure meter, respectively. Notice that I slipped and called this price discrimination. I think this is what this is called, although the MBA types have started to call it dynamic pricing. Doesn't that sound exciting? How about some dynamic pricing? And I guess lawyers are sort of in the habit of doing this too. I told somebody we were doing a project with the Berkman Center called Digital Discovery, and I was like, that sounds so exciting, Digital Discovery. I said, no, it's about document production. So here's what Amazon side of things might look like. Here's everything they've got on John Doe on the left, how many unique visits, revenue per visit, average time before buy is 9 minutes, giving him a trigger happy rating of 9.8. Or on the other hand, over here you have somebody who waits 43 minutes before buying something, much more careful when parting with his money. His trigger happy rating is 4.3. In this instance, you can see one way in which privacy can start to bite again. When I ask people on the internet, what are you really worried about on your privacy, there's a lot of just, well, I don't want my medical records floating around, and I know we're going to talk about that later today, but also just, it's about targeted advertising. If they know that I have a dog, they'll send me dog food ads. That's not the, you know, kind of cry me a river sort of thing that really gets people going. So, all right, you'll get dog food ads. But these are some things for which that same data can be used, which really starts to, I forgive the pun, have some bite to it as they go along. I now see, this is now the final point as we get to the ubiquitous internet. I can see this becoming ubiquitous. This isn't just about surfing the internet. Here is something called the QCAT. A number of people have heard of the QCAT. You can get yours for free. It is counterintuitively a cat that acts like a mouse. It's a cat that you hold like a mouse and plug into your computer, and you're supposed to sit at your computer and scan barcodes with it. So you'll get a Radio Shack catalog, and you scan the barcode, and when doing that, it'll jump to the appropriate web page with the product for you. Of course, at the same time, your cat has its own serial number, so as you scan it and you visit the page, they know exactly who you are, at least in as far as you're the person that visited us before and looked at and bought these particular products, so you can start, again, getting to know who your customers are and dynamically price them. Here is the QCAT convergence cable. That's right, internet-enhanced television. This is the ubiquity on the way. You can run a cable from the TV to the computer, so as you're watching TV, little signals are sent through the cable that have your computer start frenetically visiting websites without you even asking for it. So you'll see product placement. There's somebody eating Doritos on Survivor. They had a picnic on Survivor. The picnic to these poor, hungry people was Doritos and Mountain Dew. And somehow they were very excited to be eating Doritos and Mountain Dew. So there on their web browser with the convergence table, Doritos and Mountain Dew ads come screaming up. Here is convergence even happening more. QCAT goes mobile with the QCAT 10. So you can walk through Heckingers, and the people with the aprons come to you. I guess, do they have Heckingers here? Home Depot, I should say. So those people with the red aprons come up to you, you ask them all sorts of questions, you scan the products that you need, you thank them very much, you leave without buying anything and go home and have your pen disgorge all the UPC codes into your computer and buy it online for what you figure might be a cheaper price. But there's no reason why Home Depot can't start doing this sort of thing as well. Here is the Shaw's reward card. Now the classic worry about the use of the Shaw's reward card is that as you go through the store and swipe it over something, yeah, you get a slight discount on something, but then they have everything you bought, and they could use it for the traditional purposes of spam and advertisement. But I say that's not the only purpose to which they can put it. They could use it at that moment to determine just how much of a discount to give you at the register. And at that point, a loaf of bread at a store no longer has a flat price. Instead, that loaf of bread is basically unpredictable as to how much it will cost. All it has is a sticker price, and nobody pays sticker. Everybody drags this and gets a discount tailored to their given behavior. You don't like it? Go a few miles to another supermarket and see what their discount card will give you as well. Very interesting phenomenon, one enabled by the internet and one that I believe represents the ubiquitous internet in all its forms. And with that, I thank you and hope to turn it over to the next person on our panel.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You can tell why we always have him as a person that gets us going in these areas, because he's always interesting. It's a new sense of what the digital divide may mean, this price discrimination opportunities, and an interesting one. You know, as someone who was in the legislature for 25 years, I used to always worry about the fact that there were years when it felt like about all we did was figure out the rules for shearing the sheep. And I now see, I thought I was getting into a new form of work, more protecting them from the shearing, and I now see again another form of convergence, which we talk about in this entire domain of whether or not our efforts are going to again be relevant to shearing the sheep and the rules that one society sets for those things. Who are we going to do next? Hiawatha? Or?
Yeah, one
okay.
Second.
You want to sit or stand?
Oh, I think I'll just sit tight and use whatever full time is left. I didn't know I was supposed to bring this a big long speech. So
I just think I went overboard.
Oh, that's okay. You're forgiven. I'm honored to be asked to say a few things. I even wrote down some notes, which is something I don't usually do, but I figured I'd better because I'm in a room full of extremely smart people. Of course, you might not have thought you were all that smart a while back. I mean, if you think about what people were thinking about 20 years ago, deciding what fields to go into, it wasn't too long ago that people would have said, oh my, you blew your chance. You shouldn't have majored in law. You should have been a computer programmer. You should have been one of the geeks. Look at what's going on there. Look at the extraordinary explosion of technology that we're seeing and the huge amounts of wealth that are being created. You missed your grand chance by becoming, I don't know, the Attorney General of California instead of this guy over here. I don't think it's turning out that way at all. It's turning out, I think, that a law degree might very well turn out to be the most important qualification for the high-tech economy of the future, because it's gotten to the point where the legal questions are beginning to outstrip the technological ones in terms of how we deal with these incredible inventions that are indeed becoming ubiquitous. It's a good problem in some respects to have, because I don't know how many people remember the view of technology that was quite common not that long ago in the writings of the George Orwells or the Ray Bradburys of the world, in which the computerization of society was going to lead to the ever-increasing centralization of power in the hands of big government, a government which would have overwhelming power over all of us and be able to, make us pretty much do whatever they wanted us to do, no matter how unpleasant, you know, like watch Survivor whether we wanted to or not or whatever. Hasn't worked out that way because the people who wrote those dystopian fantasies really didn't, in fact, I don't think anybody except a few people out on the West Coast, fully understood how the technology was going to become radically less expensive and therefore more ubiquitous than anybody had ever previously thought, putting it into the hands of pretty much everyone. And so a lot of the social and legal problems that we're facing as a result of the ubiquity of the Internet are not just about the centralized powers that be abusing this technology to oppress the masses, but the masses abusing this technology in a variety of ways, potentially, to oppress, Metallica and other such people. The implications are far more complicated than anybody ever thought, because there are so many different levels at which the ubiquity of the Internet is forcing people to rethink issues of law. And you have the obvious things like privacy. Again, you have the imagination of a world in which the government knows everything about you. And that's something that people in law and philosophy are used to thinking about, but now we're having to think a lot more about the idea that it won't just be the government that will know practically everything about you, but as Mr. Zittrain so beautifully illustrated, in so many different ways, we're entering a world in which commercial organizations know more and more and more about you, in many cases much more than the government knows, and with far fewer limits on what they can do with that information, because we're used to regulating what governments do with the information that they collect. We're used to thinking that way. It's the concept of protecting the individual from the power of the state is very well established. But we're not as good at thinking about what happens when there are thousands of corporations using their internet connections to the general public to steadily acquire ever more information about us and then use it in ways we don't know anything about. And how we're supposed to deal with that is still completely unclear to us. I mean, one favorite recent example involved the use of cookies and, of course, the company DoubleClick. Cookies, you have to remember, were originally invented as a way to allow the internet to be personalized without them knowing who you were as a person. They could basically personalize your computer, but they didn't know who you were. So along comes a company called DoubleClick that decides, hey, I've got an idea. I'm going to use this method that I've dreamed up to link the information in cookies to another database that has your name and address and all kinds of other information in it. And so suddenly, millions of people who had thought that the cookies protected their anonymity were going to find that, in fact, the cookies could actually be used to identify them as individual people. It terrified and infuriated a lot of people. I wrote a column bitterly denouncing it. And the federal government jumped in and announced an investigation, and DoubleClick put the plans on hold. But nobody has yet fully resolved legally whether or not they can do something like that. That's just one of the illustrations of how this is becoming a problematical issue. Obviously, you got into the issue of Napster and the widespread distribution of other people's property. I have to say I have nothing but contempt for Napster as a company because, as you undoubtedly know, they're a company that basically had a bunch of people sitting around a table, a bunch of affluent venture capital types who said, hey, I know, let's get rich by giving away burglar tools to the general public. And by the way, when people attempted to get inside the software of Napster to learn how it worked, the same people turned around and said any attempts to reverse engineer Napster and find out exactly how it works are a violation of our intellectual property and will be punished to the fullest extent of the law. Really just a contemptible bunch of hypocrites. I have no patience for them at all. But there is a real issue here about whether or not the attempts to fight Napster are going to end up putting us in a situation in which we have less control over intellectual property than we currently have. Again, see, you're just ruining things for me because you're covering so much of this stuff. There are so many efforts afoot in law and also to some extent in technology to try to make it harder and harder for people to make copies of various kinds of intellectual property. Harder, in fact, than it is now. And so you might end up with a future in which you have fewer rights than you have now. Today you have the right to make a copy of a piece of recorded music for your own personal use, and the law recognizes that. But it's at least conceivable that technologies may be developed that will make it physically impossible for you to do that. You mentioned the fact that more and more efforts are moving in the direction of actually building that into hardware so that when you buy the computer of the future, it may well contain a chip which basically says you can't copy certain kinds of material. You can only have one copy on your computer and you can't make any more. Should we allow that? Should we give Disney that much power over how their intellectual property is used? I'm not convinced we should, but you guys are among the ones who are going to have to sort that kind of thing out. That's one more of the problems that you're up against here. And one that I'm surprised didn't get mentioned. I mean, you covered the waterfront so thoroughly. But one of the things I'm waiting to hear about in terms of the ubiquity of the Internet is its implications for taxation. We continue to hear a very strong advocacy for the idea that the Internet should not be taxed. Just last week, the Vice President of the United States said, we want no sales taxes on the Internet. I'm one of those who's not entirely clear on why that should be, especially as the Internet becomes ubiquitous. It's going to be some time before enough retail sales occur on the Internet to really make this a major economic issue for the states. But since there are state attorneys general here, you're going to have to start thinking about this. The federal government, you know, you have a vice president saying, we're not going to tax this stuff. But meanwhile, you're looking at an ever larger potential pool of state tax revenues disappearing, going out of reach because people are buying things on the Internet instead of buying them in meat space, as they say, in a brick-and-mortar store. Are we just going to allow that to happen? Some people say almost as if it were a religious conviction that you must not tax internet commerce. There are people like me who will pretty much oppose taxation on principle, and I don't care if they don't tax it. It's fine with me if they don't, but I can't think of any principle reason why they shouldn't. And this is one of the things that you guys are going to have to think about long and hard. And that's why it turns out that a degree in law is infinitely more useful and probably will be for the next 20 years in determining the future of the internet than all the PhDs in electrical engineering that you and I never got. And with that, I'll turn it over to somebody who did get a few of those.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Hiawatha.
Oh, just briefly, by the way, I got to run out and make a phone call. I'll be right back.
Okay.
He's calling his broker.
thank you, Hiawatha. And the tax issues are probably more urgent for our principal clients, governors and others, seem to routinely discuss those matters. This rascal, John Gage, and I met each other many years ago at Berkeley, where he displayed tendencies that helped get him where he is today, and that was the student that had the box that it would allow people to call home across the country without paying. early signs of genius in the electronic domain. And it's interesting because as Tom Miller, spent many hours talking to him on occasion about, well, and maybe he'll say it, I don't know, that all we do is copy. That's all this magic is. And what does that mean in terms of our commerce and privacy and other issues? Well, John.
I'd forgotten about that, Bill. I'd forgotten about that, but it's quite true. There's a reason that we're in a room that has no electricity. My PC here, just the battery died. I've been scrabbling around. This is what you do in front of state attorney generals. You crawl under tables hunting for some way to plug your machine in. No power. Now, from California, I suppose, we can't really say too much about that. But that's a reason why this is called the law school and over there is called the engineering school. Just right over there. Lots of power, lots of bandwidth, none of this retrofitting of old design. But that's what engineering is. Engineering is building things, thinking they're going to work, and watching them break. Every bridge that stands, stands because of a bridge that broke. Every champagne glass you use is a certain thickness because champagne glasses that weren't that thick broke. So engineering is a process of successive approximation, as is the law. How else? I thought, as Hiawatha was talking, I thought there's an absolute spiritual linkage between those in engineering and those in the law, because you're always reaching for something. You're trying to find words to convey what it is you do. You're never there. You're constantly redefining new metaphors, new ways of explaining something. On this machine, which I can't show you, but I was going to show you a list of the single sentences that define what the internet is. Who invented all this stuff? And there I have a table that shows about 15 single sentence, you could call them metaphorical descriptions, of what is the internet, what is a computer, and each of those single sentences created a way of thinking that organized the activities of a lot of people, which turned into the computer industry that made this thing. Well, take this computer. You're looking at its screen here. I don't quite know how Jonathan got it to turn off here, so I was going to use this to browse the net, but now it's in some funny state. This device, you see its screen up there, has a keyboard. There you all tapped it. Oh, there we are. Great. Hey, and we're on the net. Not bad. Okay, now we're in business. Thank you, Jonathan. I looked up, in fact, I can do it right now, I think. I looked up before I, last night when I got in, which was late, I looked up what Jonathan's doing. And here's how I look things up. I go to Google, and when I get to Google, I put in Jonathan, and then I search. And I discovered that Jonathan is teaching a course, probably in 10 minutes. And the course he's teaching is called Torts. So Jonathan, in teaching Torts, and today, this very day, you're supposed to be talking about liability. Where's the syllabus? I found the syllabus here. Course materials. Here's the syllabus. So today, Jonathan is taking words well known, well, maybe not to the students, trespass, intentional harm, negligence. These are four words you're quite familiar with. Causation. Well, that came after spring break. I like that. Causation. After you get back from spring break, you try to remember what you did and see if there was some reason. It talks about strict liability. Well, that's right now. In fact, today's lecture is supposed to be product liability. Is that right? So if you go to... Now, were this fully there, there are some documents. I discovered you don't have today's talk, but you have what's going to pop up for the next class. With some luck, it'll come across the net. Well, maybe it won't. So, in any case, the materials that I've just brought here are exactly what Bill said. They're copies. Everything in the computer is a copy. Everything's a copy. So that's a little bit of what underlies Barlow's drug-induced states of how do we use language. We've got a word problem. If everything's a copy, what does copyright mean? That page you saw, this one, that just came across the net, sat on a disk someplace. I don't know if John even knows where it is, but it's somewhere. Sits on a disk. It's been backed up, so there's copies, various places. And in this process of making its way from that disk to this screen, it's gone through 5, 10, 15, 20 computers, copied in each one, pieces sent by packets through many different computers. They've been reassembled here. That's all the internet is. It's a way of taking pieces of information, breaking them in little pieces, putting an address of where they're headed, dump them out on the net, let them wander around, and then put them back in order after they've been copied multiple. And there's copies now probably on 10 computers between here and Jonathan's original disk of this document for the class. Who owns that stuff? And in the process of getting here, it had to keep a list in the computer of the destination for those packets. The first packet headed out of that initial disk of Jonathan's and got to a machine. Says, does anybody know the way to that plug in the wall at the Harvard Law School in the Ames Auditorium? I don't, said the first computer it got to, but I have a friend that does. And it went over there and it found the IP routing stuff over there and it built a routing table and it went to the next one. Who owns that stuff? This is called data routing tables, built dynamically, and they're in these machines all over the place. This is the pathway that this page took to get here. Well, these are very interesting questions which go at the base to language. So I thought I'd tell you about a couple of technical things, because we don't think so well about language. Language drives how we think. Language says things like, I have here a cell phone. Well, isn't that silly? This isn't a telephone. It's a radio and a computer. It's not a telephone. It's a radio, which means that anybody right now, within about 4,000 meters, can hear me. Because every second I'm saying, hi, it's me, it's John, hi. And right around Harvard Square, 6 antennas or so, hear me. And they all talk all the time. Who's got him the loudest? I've got him the loudest. If a phone call comes in from his daughter, send it to me because I've got him the loudest. If you look down on a map of Cambridge, each of these 6 antennas in some sense has a circle drawn around it about how loud the little radio they're listening to in my hand captures me. So they overlap those circles, and where am I? Right in the intersection. Remember the Gestapo little radio trucks we had? We aim that antenna. What's the strongest? The hot seems to be coming from over there. Well, let's go over there. Well, the stationary antennas that make up the cellular telephone system of the United States of America and of every country in the world listen to this phone every second or so, announce me, announce my PIN number, getting ready for a phone number to come in. And under United States law now, if I hit 911, the phone company is required to report to law enforcement my location within 50 yards, maybe 100 yards. That's an interesting law. It's the 911 docket of the FCC. Only works if you hit 911. Do we believe that? It works all the time. Now, these antennas are spaced at a kilometer or two. Go to Japan. This is the worst crummy phone system. I mean, if you want liability issues, go take these nitwits in the cellular telephone industry, you know. None of this stuff works. I was just in China. By the end of this year, they'll have 100 million cell phones. Next year, they'll have 200 million. They're the single biggest cellular telephone market in the world. Beats the U.S. by far. Go to any place in Europe. The cell phones actually work. Go to Japan. The Docomo phones, they sell 1 million a month. See this guy? The screen on the little Docomo phone that might cost you $50 or $100 is as large as the entire surface area of this color. Receives all your web pages, all your mail, 8 megabytes of memory. Cheap little guy. Hello Kitty, little pink phones. Every teenage kid in Japan's got one of these things. They're all sending each other short messages. Try to teach in a classroom. You think Napster is a distraction for the students? Looking pretty cute after spring break. I have messages going around in every classroom. Well, those cellular telephone systems work. Ours do not work. Ours are insecure. I did a demonstration for House Telecom in which I took a cell phone. You can do it to any of the ones you have in your pocket. After getting dispensation from the general counsel, I had to get a dispensation. It took 2 months to get the general counsel for House Commerce Committee to say any action taken by these witnesses is in the interest of the people of the United States and is therefore not you can't take these guys to jail. We give these guys prior immunity. So I made little t-shirts up for all my group. Prior immunity, can't bust me. In front of everybody, we took the phone. Remember, it's not a phone, it's a computer and a radio. If you hit 12 keystrokes on this phone, you put it in service mode. You know, you drop it, you take it to be repaired. Somebody has to check the radio. So you put it in service mode and you put hit start at frequency 0000 and go up every quarter second, half second, step through all the frequencies, go, bend the microphone down, as I did in front of the House Telecommunications Committee, and poop stops on the first phone, goes, hi honey, I'm going to be a little late for lunch, I'm going to be held down here at the job, next frequency. Well, Bill, I don't think we can get Joe to go along on this, but if we got his L.A. behind this, every member of Congress sat straight up because this is wiretap, trivial wiretap, not defended by any technical trivial chip you could put in one of these things. Is there a liability issue that every United States telephone call made is completely vulnerable to a six-year-old to be able to listen to? People that do this, I hear, will spend their time in the morning on commute hour listening to every person listening to their voicemail. Every contract in Silicon Valley. We as vice presidents and senators have had notes put on their desk. They come to work and say, you idiot, you discussed some business on the phone one more time and we're going to come in and yank out everything signed Love Engineering because everybody can hear everything on the American cell phone systems. Now the digital ones are a little bit better. Is there a presumption someplace that a product has a certain level of capability? That coalition that Jonathan mentioned about HP and Microsoft and Intel to make the PCs work? PCs are junk. There's no way to make them secure. End of story. Now, is that a liability issue? I think we ought to go to your class and find out because somewhere in here in the law of liability and torts. Well, let me tell you the four basic things that I think are going to hit us really fast. Yes, the stuff, everything talks. Okay, so take some examples of precisely what Jonathan And Hiawatha both talked about this funny new term you're going to hear called peer-to-peer. What is all this about? Well, try this example. All of you that are parents failed because your children asked you to get a PlayStation for Christmas and you couldn't because Sony couldn't make enough of them. All right, you failed. PlayStations are a $299 box with a DVD player in them. That's a pretty impressive box. And they have a plug in the side that lets you put a 400 megabit pipe in. It's called the IEEE 1394 plug. It's this little square guy on the side here. That means you can put a disc in. I bought a disc 6 weeks ago. 80 gigabytes, $350. Mac store. I could do it from this screen. 80 gigabytes. 80 gigabytes for a disc times the 10 million PlayStations that will be sold by May 15, there'll be 10 million sold. 80 gigabytes times 10 million boxes is 800,000 terabytes of online storage. How much is that? All of Citicorp, everything Citicorp has, is under 100 terabytes. Everything the Pentagon has. This is more storage than everything but the National Reconnaissance Office, the image files in the observation. This is a lot of storage. This is kids with PS2s, all made to be on the internet, by May. Now, let's see, 80 gigabytes, that's about 50,000 songs. Not bad. But notice that's a DVD player in it, nitwits in the entertainment industry. We're going to zone you, so if you buy a DVD in Norway and you go to New York, you can't play it. Huh. So it took a kid in Norway about a week to work out how to hack that one. So it runs a Linux program out on the net, allows you to just fix it. So when you buy something somewhere, you can see it wherever you are, and it seems reasonable. This PS2 will run Linux, does right now. So let's take 10 million PlayStations, May 2001, running Linux. That means every DVD player that you put a Sony movie in, then is instantly converted, put on that 80 gigabyte disk. We have Napster for movies, May 2001. It's over. Valenti stood here in this room and said, oh, these Harvard Law students, so intelligent, too bad you can't tell crime when you see it, you know, went on like that. Well, Valenti, here's what's happening. We have unlimited storage. We have enormous amounts of bandwidth. We have countries like China moving directly, and in the there are 1,000 Chinese universities at this moment with 2 megabit to 100 megabit and soon to gigabit connectivity. At this moment, minimum 2 megabit connectivity, 1,000 Chinese universities. That's it for the leadership. I mean, we've changed the way China thinks. So suddenly these technical devices, which are just as Hiawatha says, cheap, they're just cheap, that's all it is, cheap, stuff doesn't cost anything, we've suddenly put a new substrate in. What's the new substrate do? The little PS2 with a big disk on it can talk to the other PS2 with a big disk on it. So I've gone to Credit Suisse, Union Bank of Switzerland, all of Citicorp, said, you guys have a terrible problem. Look at California. You have all your data sitting on a huge pile of suns off in a closet somewhere. And somebody turns off the power. This is bad. You know, it's bad when all the bank data goes away. So what you should do is distribute it all over. So why don't you just buy a million PlayStations, give them to a million kids, and just reserve a little piece of that disk, take your data, replicate it 10,000 times, chop it in little pieces, spread it all over, never die. The data will never die. Boy, the banks love that. So they're going to do that. So they're going to do that. Banks pay attention. There are liability issues. What happens if things go down? So the PlayStation is an example of a new movement to allow these small devices, not going through a central server, but just to talk to each other. So you're going to hear Wednesday, we're going to announce with every peer-to-peer player in the world, this is real boring stuff, at the very bottom of making these little computers linked on the net as they are, and these computers on at the bottom, when you're trying to make two or three things, or 10 or 1,000 or a billion, all talk to them, you have to answer some fundamental questions with the core of the law. Who are you? There's a fundamental issue. Who are you? Am I Jonathan? Am I John? Am I Hiawatha? Am I Bill? You better ID yourself. So you have a standard way of figuring out who you are. And then you better figure out what permissions do you have in this set of circumstances at this moment. That's it. That's all there is to computer security. Who are you? What permissions do you have? So on Wednesday, we're going to put out all the code we've developed over the last year that allow at the bottom any computational process, that is any program running on anything, to ID itself. And when it does something, there's a result. So you have to characterize what the result is. So figure out a way to do that. And then the basic security model, so that billions of devices all talking to each other are able to interchange programs and migrate stuff all over the place. This all works. It means I start this thing up. Jonathan mentioned Nutella. Well, actually, here's on this. We're in a classroom, so here is an absolute assignment. Everybody must go try Napster. Must go try Nutella. How can you understand it if you don't do it? You've got to do it. Go try Nutella. Nutella is just a little tiny program that lets one computer tell you what it's got. Pictures, movies, it's all just digital data, programs, and share them. That's it. Hi, what do you have? I've got this. Oh, I've got that. Well, can I have this? Sure. It's all that there is to it. Trivial protocols to make one thing share with the other. But if you don't have a common security model, then you can't build a world that's better than today's cell phone system or today's network of PCs, this disaster we have. So what's coming now are these cheap and ubiquitous devices. How cheap? Bill and I are from Berkeley. Berkeley is a bastion, in some sense, of don't tread on me. All around Berkeley, you may not know this, Bill, all around Berkeley, there's a project at this moment, we're big believers in this, if you take a little chip, really little, how little? Well, a millionth of a meter is how the size of things on a chip. Take a slab of silicon, dig out a swimming pool, and leave the diving board. Tiny, millionth of a meter. Swimming pool, the diving board. Now, if you bump it, the diving board wobbles. You can tell how much it wobbles. This engineers call an accelerometer. You all own one if you own a newish car because it's what determines if your airbag deploys. Costs nothing, a little slab of silicon. So it vibrates, and that tells you how big the bump was. I could put one of those babies into an envelope. I could put it into a container freight. I could put a little clock on it. I can tell if anybody dropped my china, FedEx sat on my package. I mean, I can tell when and where, under whose position was that device. That's what costs nothing. Take that little sensor technology. You can do a lot of others. Temperature, fluid flow. Is there an electric field? You can make those things a millionth of a meter, and then you slap on the back end a little tiny wireless guy, a millionth of a meter. Doesn't sense. You can send light out from it or radio waves, just depends on how much power you have. These little guys in the millions will be deployed around the Berkeley campus. In the military world, these have been for many years called smart dust. Because you're near a battlefield, you want to know where everybody is. Gee, I heard a crunch over there. What's the password? Smart dust. This has been the subject of an investment by all of us in this room of billions of dollars, so little tiny guys can tell when somebody dangerous is coming towards you or what's going on out there. We're going to scatter them around and put them on every device that uses energy on the Berkeley campus. We're going to have metering sensors that are forming a peer-to-peer network that conveys information about everything going on. What about the medical community? People want to take care of you. They'd sure like to be able to tell cholesterol levels. You know, if you won't buy a cell phone that monitors your cholesterol level, your mother will. You know, Bill, wear yours, you know, and take care of yourself. Don't drink that coffee. I mean, God, it's bad for you. So the monitoring and the communication capabilities are coming together. So you add the spatial component, which the 911 symbolizes, but think of antennas not on kilometer spacings, but on 100-meter spacings. That's sub-meter resolution. And that means that at all times, the devices you carry with you announce your location within less than a meter. Very useful in commerce. You walk along and it says, there's an empty table at the restaurant. Gee, there's a sale on right here. How interesting, because the data comes to you because people know where you are. The three elements Jonathan put up, law enforcement, consumer protection, and competition, are three states of mind. And the law enforcement state of mind is, we're going to take care of Jonathan because we will just, if we know where he is at all times, we can take care of it. What if he fell down? We can take it. This is all a very legitimate point of view. It's not the same frame of mind as in the competitive mode where you're saying, well, there are varying costs and we'll make different things compare against each other. We have no absolute rules about taking care of Jonathan. If he's ready to pay, he gets a little bit more care than he used to before. And consumer protection, which has this other nurturing feeling about it, that we're going to watch out for his independence and his rights, that's a different frame of mind. You have to reconcile all three. So just to summarize what I'm trying to describe for you, we're in a world where with the PlayStation 2 announcement and this 1080 gigabyte disk stuff that costs nothing, we have ubiquitous storage. The 911 means we have locational data telling us about where everything is. The Docomo example, these million-a-month small cell phones, tell us that everybody's going to have a little cheap guy that lets you link into the network everywhere. The Smart Dust example says that we're going to have data that flows from devices, which today seem dumb, but which we in the computer world technically say are beginning to come alive. The coffee cup, the sensor about cholesterol, the locational data coupled with the accelerometer sitting in your envelope, all of these things are changing the foundation of information, which now requires words to be created to describe rights, responsibilities, and liabilities. So I think we should all go to Jonathan's course now and learn about strict liability. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John. Did it again. It's interesting, one of the last legislative debates in which I participated was one in which the cellular telephone industry wanted to change California liability laws so that when someone had a misfortune of rape, and they call 911 or someplace for help from their cellular phone, and the call gets dropped, which seems to be what happens more than it working, in my experience, that they wouldn't be liable for the resulting personal harm. I was, I guess, mostly the person responsible for killing that legislative proposal and live to regret it at the next campaign cycle. But anyhow, it's nice to have you make us think about those in so many different contexts. I'm not sure how comfortable I am having my medical records or financial information on the neighbor's sunny PlayStation, but extraordinary changes. And at the moment, I'll ask if any of you wish to kind of react or comment or question each other, or if someone here wishes to raise a point that they do. It seems to me, though, that one of the related new issues that's sort of where John concluded, and that is you're walking down the street and any business that you walk by will be able to tell you what the status is of their prices and services and what's available, and that that raises a recent controversy in California, and I suspect probably it already is or will be elsewhere, and that is spamming, that is unwanted messages or advertising that wind up now on your PC and shortly or in some places wind up on your handheld radio computer. Or personal assistant, or digital messenger, the various kinds of ways we can communicate with offices and others, you get the ads from various vendors. You pay to get the ad. And the question is raised of whether that's fair to have the customer pay for receiving the ad. I think not. I don't know what the law is yet and whether it's sufficient to avoid that kind of cost shifting. And it's a recent debate that we're getting into in California. Well, I remember the thought as a kid, necessity is the mother of invention. And now we find, of course, the greater truth may be that invention is the mother of necessity. Did anything provoke either of you or any of the three of you in each other's comments? Or I'm going to kind of push this into some else?
we should open it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone want questions, comments from anyone here that would want to get these guys started? I'll be, please.
Actually, I was sort of surprised about what, during the comment about that, because we already deal with that on a regular basis. It's happened. This is the routine way business is done in the airline industry. Variable dynamic pricing, they practically invented it, using their computers to decide which ticket purchasers should get which price. It's routine there. And in fact, I think it has, for the most part, unless you're a business traveler, been very good for the airline using for the consuming public, because it's one of the key reasons why people like you and me, when we happen to want to take a trip and we know 2 or 3 weeks in advance that we're going to go, we get this rock bottom fare while the guy sitting next to us is paying $1,000 for a one-way ticket. So yeah, this is already going on. You know, there is also, on the flip side of that, the possible phenomenon of a consumer-oriented approach on the internet based on the use of agent technology, software that automatically goes out looking for the cheapest prices. And in fact, if we're not careful, you could actually end up with this sort of bizarre race to the bottom phenomenon, because there have already been websites that, I don't know, there was one that was bought out by BarnesandNoble.com, where what happened was the website would automatically, when you looked for a book on this website, it would go to 10 other websites that sold books, see what they charged, and automatically charge like 5% less. They automatically did that. Now, on the other hand, a consumer could have an agent that goes out and looks for the lowest price and keeps reporting back to all the other various websites. And if enough internet companies use that kind of strategy, your computer could keep constantly bidding them lower and lower and lower, and you could end up getting a situation where you got an incredibly low price by all these companies trying to outbid each other for your business. So it works both ways.
I find myself thinking like the end of a Newsweek article where they invariably conclude that the future is uncertain, but one thing is clear. If things don't get better, they could get a whole lot worse. So I think Hai is right on one point that, you know, the internet is, well, on this point in particular, that the internet has empowered this agent technology. On the other hand, here we have law stepping in, the eBay versus Bidder's Edge case, in which exactly that practice was held to be a trespass. Talk about tort. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trespassing on our server with your Bidder's Edge robots. We don't want you here. And the court says, you know what, sounds like trespass to me. So I think there's some implications from cases like that that actually bear on how easy it would be to do this kind of price discrimination. And it really is just a battle to see if there's surplus to be had. Does it go to the consumer in the form of lower prices, or to the producer in the form of capturing a monopoly rent? The drug example that you raise is a monopolist who has the patent trying to figure out how to deploy it. There's a monastic manuscript kind of limit on the consumer's ability to arbitrage, which just is you have to ship the drugs. You can imagine making the drugs so that they have to be refrigerated, something that would make it awfully hard to get it from Sri Lanka back to here in order to do the arbitrage. And we see it in intellectual property, which is also a form of monopoly with copyrighted, say, DVDs, where they've done these regional DVD encodings, so that if you try to buy the lower priced movie in Britain and ship it here, it won't play unless you've got one of John's friends to help you out. So I think it could go either way. This is why it's a Newsweek ending. But a lot of cards are still in the hands of the people building the systems and providing the content.
I think there is a direction, though, that is clear. The international regimes on provision of services. So today the Chinese are concerned that all the foreign financial, the insurance crowd and all are going to start offering products and absolutely kill the Chinese, which is true, because the provision across the net of a service, a financial service, doesn't cost anything, and if you're a big bank and sophisticated, you know how to do it. You can get into that market under WTO accession rules, and you can just rip right through a lot of terrain, which would be hard for the quite inefficient entities in China to. On the other hand, provision of legal services, you don't care where you are. You know, you're a smart person, you can be anywhere. So for Commonwealth countries, the notion that some lawyer or an accountant in Jamaica can provide accounting or legal services to someone in England scares a lot of people, and yet that's going to happen. I don't think there's any, we'll see. We watched the car dealers block a lot of the price, just as I was saying, that the software he describes is the second week homework assignment in a sophomore MIT computer science class. I mean, I could show anyone in this room how in 20 minutes to build this find the cheapest book thing. It's trivially easy. So, you know, that kind of the used car guys really shut down in many states the opportunity for people to have a fulfillment of a car deal. So they're fighting in the state legislatures to oppose, in some sense, this consumer right to try and find prices that are, you know, reasonable. But I think the services regime, we're going to see a huge transformation because you can provide them at very little cost across, you know, across any geographic boundary. Mm-hmm.
Should we care about Sun and Microsoft being major investors in Docomo, which is a sub of the largest phone company in the world, Nippon TNT, and I don't mean that as a just standalone example, but there's enormous amount of cash in the form of the extraordinary profits for some companies that then is getting placed in strategic ways throughout evolving technologies. Should we care about that? Do we have a role?
Well, I don't think we have any choice but to care. I don't know if you want to single out a Sun or a Microsoft or anything. It's just that, well, the basic problem is that as these technologies are developed and deployed, the very way they're developed and the very way they're deployed set limits on the way people use them, shape the way in which people use these technologies, like the example that you mentioned. Suppose we find ourselves in a future in which the computers have already been built, pre-constructed with chips inside them to set limits on what we can and can't do with them. We already had the phenomenon with that standard, remember the standard that was being discussed for installation into portable devices that would limit the ability of this portable device to make copies of MP3 files. Well, there was also some reason to believe that there was a plan afoot to include that same technology into hard drives. And in theory, that could end up with a situation where you install, say, Microsoft Office on your hard drive, and then the hard drive itself sets limits on what you can do with Microsoft Office. People were furious about this, and they jumped up and down and yelled and screamed, and one of the standards bodies that establishes the design of this hard drive interface said, no, we're not going to do that, we're not going to do that. But what happens next time? It could be very troubling, and a lot of it's going to depend on what companies like IBM, which was taking part in this, decide they want to build into their hardware. And we have to really wonder about whether or not we want to just sit idly by and let companies do that.
Jonathan, on that topic at all?
I think I'll.
Okay. Let me, John? Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say we never really cared about Microsoft because the software they had was junky and didn't matter particularly. But the monopoly on the desktop yielded a lot of cash. So now you're suddenly in this funny situation where somebody has 20 or 30 billion bucks in the bank and they go around and they buy customers. Hi, AT&T, you're a little company. We're Microsoft, and we'll put $5 billion into buying the set-top box stuff, but only on the provision that you put Microsoft software in there. Now that's a very
It didn't work. Well, no, they as I recall, this is coming from my memory of Canaletta's book. They did indeed try to get exclusivity on these boxes, and the companies basically said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll do business with you, but we're not going to give you exclusive control over the technology in our set-top box.
Well, I don't know the final resolution of this, but the $5 billion got them the Microsoft software in the set-top boxes. Since then someone pointed out that made them a lot more expensive and a lot less secure than they were otherwise. It wasn't a good commercial step because you suddenly I can't compete. these things do take a pathway based to some degree on merit. But market power is just a... I never appeal to principle on these things. These are just set of circumstances. They're just, at some point, somebody has an enormous amount of market power. In the issue of the Docomo phone, the reason, one of the reasons it's so successful, the Japanese, instead of doing what the Americans or the Europeans did, they said, we're going to allow this little phone to show any web page, no weird proprietary thing. So we'll have HTML. So you buy one and you can look at a couple hundred thousand web pages instantly because they didn't do anything weird. People said, this is great. I'm not bound to one thing. I can look at Yahoo on my phone. I can look at all these things. So they said, we're going to allow Java, which is just a programming language, to run on all these phones. That means anybody can add something into the phone to add some new value. Suddenly 1,000 developers flower, which means that the customers are happy because there are 1,000 new things. They're not held to the slow tedium of waiting for one manufacturer to dream up something. Now there's innovation possible. So opening the boundaries so anybody can participate, as new things occur. So our general attitude toward this is you can try and do it, you can try and lock down things with your market power or your money, and at some point the technology's decrease in cost is going to liberate things so you can move on. So no matter who tries, but at this point you bring up about putting secret codes inside disks and keeping track of them. All the chips have a little ID number in them. It's because you make them so you can figure out, was this a defective batch or not. You can use that ID number in all sorts of horrible ways. So it's how you use the thing.
Over there, Smith, I'm sure he's going to tell you guys all about it.
Mm-hmm. So the moment that we've always worried, we're now 43,000 people. Let's say I'm an intelligence agency somewhere in the world, and I want to have an influence on what happens in computers that belong to people I don't like later on. Why don't I get some smart engineers to go inside and work in these companies? So our chips have, our new ones have 100 million transistors. This is a really complicated roadmap of different colored lines on a chip. Let's just put a little extra circuitry in there so that when you send it XYZZY, the chip links the metal layer to the ground layer and you blow out the chip. Trivial to stick this into a chip.
Let's hope
who knows?
My plan had that in their chip.
Let's say that somebody working for who knows what government put it inside the Intel chips. When the kid was caught, the world's most wanted computer criminal, Satoshi Nomura, captured this guy who was taking over people's web files. I'm forgetting his name. Kevin Mitnick. Mitnick had stolen Motorola's design files for the chips for the Motorola cell phone. If he were more sophisticated, he could have altered those design files and put them back, and Motorola would have manufactured cell phones with unknown circuitry inside them. Maybe. You don't know that?
I would
get you guys worried about some of the things.
That's a very good point. I just want to say this very briefly because it drives me crazy looking at all these stories about these genius hackers who go around putting up pornographic pictures on the CIA website. It's idiotic. He just described what a lot of people who are looking at the law enforcement angle of the ubiquitous Internet really had better start worrying about, because sooner or later somebody's going to be smart enough to figure out what they should really do, which is to break into very critical websites and subtly modify important pieces of information in ways that could sabotage banks, that could sabotage industries, simply by changing the information inside a database in some subtle way that wouldn't be obvious until it was too late. That's going to happen sooner or later, and that's going to be far more dangerous than most of these hacking exploits we're always hearing about.
I count on government incompetence as our best protection, but the hackers, as one of our colleagues from Missouri likes to say, we law enforcement people catch the dumb ones, and the smart ones maybe are going to be more able to do bad things unapprehended. Any other comments? Last point anyone want to make? Because it's one of the current debates, and I think there are different perspectives reflected here, but I'm not certain. One of the current debates in the States is USITA, and whether it makes sense to develop a separate commercial code for software products, and that is pulling it out of the UCC sales of goods provisions of the law. Any reactions to that development?
I'm going to say briefly, I'm not as familiar with UCITA as I should be, but I have read it in the past and did not care for it at all. It seemed to me that it gives too much rights to the software manufacturers to basically saddle consumers with inferior quality products. They always tell us it's almost unavoidable for software to have a certain a number of bugs in it. But by the way, this is one of the very problems with the ubiquity of the Internet. It has given software developers a new excuse for making crappy products. They routinely release products onto the market that are of very low quality and then say, oh, by the way, we're going to have all these problems that we already know are there. We're going to have them fixed. You just have to go to the Internet, download a patch, and fix them. But the effect is that the overall standard of quality for commercial software is being driven lower by the presence of the Internet, and I fear UCITA may just make the process worse.
As a legal anthropological matter, mm-hmm. It's interesting to see UCC2B die, be interred, and then moments later Lazarus-like rise as UCITA, and people talk about it if it's a new thing a lot of the time. My ideal world would be one in which some of the arguments about UCITA were actually brought together with some of the worries about taxation and harmonization of schemes. I mean, as I read the political picture for state sales tax, the federal government, the Congress, has basically said, all right, guys, you know, go back, talk amongst yourselves, and see if you can come up with a plan.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you have to harmonize the rate or something, but, you know, get some definitions going, get some reciprocity going, and if you can come up with a scheme that doesn't seem harebrained, you know, it might be come back tomorrow with the broom from the Wicked Witch, and when you do, there'll be a new task. But at least if you take them at your word, Congress says you work it out, and we'll enter into a compact with you. We'll help ratify it. I'd love to see UCC actually be part of UCITA, excuse me, be part of that process. So you bring into one, under one roof, the rules by which contracts are formed and interpreted to some extent, and by which the tax is collected and paid, and I could see some maybe useful horse trading that would go on there. I say that even as I understand that the opportunities for so-called zoning are going up. It's exactly some of the technologies that these guys have been talking about that make it a lot easier for your computer to advertise, by the way, I'm in Missouri right now, and you should behave accordingly, you know, as far as whatever tax you're going to collect or whether you will, and as far as what rules of contract may obtain. You know, this is the not valid in Wisconsin sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can be handled quite well with the technology once you've got the location down.
They keep telling us how wonderful the technology is, but then seem to not be able to tell you what state you're in to impose the tax. But, yes, Johnny, you care about this at all?
Well, I'm just thinking I'm sitting in a state that it used to tax people by the size of the window, so that's why there's so many houses with small windows in Massachusetts. Whatever moves can be taxed, and the benefit of labeling and everything that exists on the net with some identifier means we have new ways of taxing. So we will identify and use these new ways of taxing. I still remember when the National Conference of Mayors came to San Francisco, like a couple of thousand mayors in a room, and Gore got up and he said, we will not tax the Internet. And every mayor in the room thought, tax the Internet? Yeah.
I recall some years ago one of my colleagues in the state Senate teasingly saying, well, the two new taxes he could imagine, and these might fit in this new cyber environment, but one was how frequently you had sex, and that there'd be some that really needed to boast and pay a big tax, and that the other was put a little meter here and you'd be taxed for how many words you spoke, which would make people more concise and maybe listen a little more. If neither of those will work, perhaps how much you are online will click a meter somewhere. I don't know if that meter ought to be in some private domain or a tax official's office, but I can see lots of possibilities. Help me thank these three for being with us.
Oh, sorry. Before we leave, I got to say one thing.
Yeah.
Nobody said anything about anonymity. I mean, you were talking about this idea we're going to tax people because we're going to have a computer knowing where we are. Do we want our computers to know where we are? I mean, right now, if you're on a typical ISP, they just give you an IP number out of a pool. And when you dial up on the internet, nobody really knows where you are. And that's a really good thing in many ways. Do we want to give that up?
I think the point was maybe we already have. But thank you all.
Thank you. We have a break for a few minutes.
Sorry,
right.
I think somebody had mentioned that.
Oh, you're right.
I want to
know where I am.
Shoot. Thank you.
Well,
that was fun.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sorry I have to duck out. I'm not going to duck out again.
I wonder if I can get back here later this evening. This is turning out to be really interesting. Please come here. I think I mentioned that I'm going to be... See, the problem is I'm trying to arrange a trip I've got to take next week. I'm going to maybe when I get a chance, I will drop back in here. And this is like today, tomorrow, and I may be able to drop back in. So this is something. Oh, yeah.
As I understand the way the house works, everyone goes in to find that statute, and then they find it somewhere with great place here.
You're going to have a new conversation. Do not have, right?
Privacy, anonymity, because there's a case last week where the guy won the right to, for the guy, I forget who it was, I don't think we know, but there was a case where the guy was sitting our company was saying, this internet provider has to tell us the names of non-responders who are saying bad things about our company. And you did that down. They don't. They have a right to post anonymous stories on the internet. I pull up in the air. That may go to the Supreme Court. That's just one example. Do people have a right to get anonymous? You don't think you're
No.
Oh, I was wondering if you think people should, every time you put it on the internet, you ask them identification.
I don't think so.
Really? No, but the only reason there are courts that are still arguing that out. And that's hacking. I was surprised. I was the first person to bring that up. That's with all these guys. You guys are really successful. You think they'll almost the internet is like from another dimension. It's not like part of the real world. And that's where this idea you can't hack the internet comes from. Precisely the way I insist on trying to believe that it is just another part of the real world. And if it is, why don't we treat it accordingly? There's no reason not to hack the internet.
Okay,
except I need to so if you don't want to do it, that's fine.
All right.
It's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, come on, set up. Don't you worry. We can look
great. 15
minutes.
I got it. Yes, I'm sorry.
They'd be in there looking good.
Thank you.
Frame the debate. Because it said high at the top. There's a red level here. There's no parking around here. Okay. Yeah, I just camped it over here.
Probably about 3 more minutes.
Director, how are you? Very good. Seeing you again. We'll have to talk to you a little bit about the flower. I talked about flower. I had a train of inquiry to my front office. What is it? How many experts we could talk to could really take us through step by step, help us identify markets and get charger reasonable rates. Anybody could send some checkups to do in a couple of days. But the other question I had is on my
Maybe get you a little more data.
Whatever.
Did your friend ever figure out the numbers thing?
Yeah. I mean, it was the fact that he had to the listed number data on the about a year ago. But he thought the web directory replaces had already been behind the table at the point. It still had a phone number. It's not really an issue with the towering web search engine doing anything wrong. The question is, if you had ways, whether or not SNET itself could have kind of screened some people, even if you get somewhere else, or anything from SNET.
Verizon, by the way, they did all the calculations.
Actually, I have to say my front office was asking, they were concerned about it, asking to contact SNET to see if they were going to do that. I've just been too busy to do it, but now that I know that Verizon is doing it, that's another thing I can say when I go to SNET and let them know what
to do. I'm looking at Shelley.
Were you going to horrify us today? With
I don't think I'm going to horrify. I never horrify.
Yeah, yeah, we're beyond being shocked at this point.
I just got a lot of energy.
The foundation still.
Yeah,
you don't actually work at it, but you work at it.
Yeah, I just work on work life. I've been
pressing him for knowledge and asking questions.
I felt bad because somebody from California asked me to come in from over here. So I was like, oh, it's raining sweater right
now. Now we have magic day.
Yeah, I know. It's really like, okay, summer.
Well, tomorrow will be the event. It's the 80 again tomorrow.
I heard that.
I don't know. It's the 80 today.
I didn't get a chance to do it. This is your 2-minute warning. We're going to get started in about 2 minutes so folks can take their seats.
Well, my guy, glad you guys are going to home in on privacy here.
I was present at this conference in San Francisco where my
Folks, we're going to start right up now. First of all, I'm delighted to introduce Richard Smith. Mr. Smith is a resident of Brookline, Massachusetts, and is the Chief Technology Officer of the Privacy Foundation. He was recently featured in a Boston Globe news article and was described as a self-confessed gadget person. The Boston Globe article went on to say that Smith is an extraordinary provocateur. Someone else has apparently laid claim to the title, the Ralph Nader of privacy, but that's essentially what Mr. Smith is. He is a total S puller back of curtains. He's beloved by reporters around the world for the scoops that he feeds them. The firms he investigates seem to disrespect his authority, and it's hardly ever a problem for him to get a direct email correspondence going with the CEO. I want to thank Mr. Smith for his dedication to internet privacy issues, including making our offices aware of the issues that should be of concern to us. We are especially grateful to Mr. Smith for the depth of his technical knowledge and expertise. The lawyers investigating cases in the area of internet privacy in our office and throughout this country rely upon experts like Richard Smith to help in the development of their cases. One thing I should note as well, for any of you that want, there are computers available in the basement. Harvard has made them available for access to back home, to certainly to your email. So any of you that need to use that service, it is available to you. But will you please join with me in welcoming Richard Smith.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to NAG for this opportunity to speak today. This is a pretty usual circumstance for me now. I'm actually a technologist, not a legal person, but I seem to be talking a lot now to lawyers over the last couple of years on the issue of how technology and law interact, in particular in the privacy area. As was said in the introduction, I work for the Privacy Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization based out of Denver, Colorado. Started about a year ago to look at really the whole issue, do research in the area of technology advances and how it's impacting privacy. Before that, a year before, I did this on my own. I had a software company which I retired from and decided to take a year off and look at privacy and security issues. So I have been really in this, only in this business, say, for a couple of years. I was asked today to to talk about consumer privacy on the Internet to sort of frame the debate or frame the discussions that are going to come later today. And what I wanted to do was sort of take a tour of the Internet and talk briefly about issues that I've been researching over the last couple of years and to help out with further discussions later today. And some of those discussions are on issues of things like notice and choice, the fair information practices, security and aspect, and so on. And what I wanted to try to do is show how today some of these issues are being played out. Where I thought I'd go first here is over to Tower Records. We all know them as the CD store, or formerly the record stores. They sell basically media products. They're all over the country. They also have, like most brick and mortar companies have, an online presence also, where you can buy music and videos and so on. Now, what's interesting is about a website, through the use of cookies, what's fundamentally different about going to an internet website versus a brick and mortar store is the internet merchant, using cookie technology, can watch and record every place we go. And a cookie, I think the best way to describe it is like a supermarket loyalty card. The first time that you come to that website, they plant a cookie on your hard drive, and it provides a unique number that identifies your computer. In most cases, that's going to be one or two people, because most computers are not shared nowadays. And then they use that cookie, then each time you go back to a web page, the cookie is sent back to them, and they can record all the different places that you go on that site. This is typically known as the click stream. So unlike a physical Tower Records store, if I want to go look at Steely Dan albums, they can record that information, then use that information to market to me. And this is when we talk about the internet commerce, e-commerce. One of the ways that it was sold was this whole idea that we get to snoop on people, attract people, and we can sell them more stuff. We can personalize the website and profile them and sell them more things. And many websites use this kind of technology of observing people as they go around the store in order to customize the view that they see. Now, what's kind of interesting about Tower Records, though, is they didn't just stop there. They also worked with a company called Codget to provide to do even more tracking of us as we use the store. Now, if we view the source code to this web page here. Not to that one, to the Tower Records. And I don't have my view source is not view sourcing, so I'm just going to have to explain it. On this page, we'll find a web bug, which is an invisible image that goes back to a company called ClickSafe. And if you go look up in the internet directory who ClickSafe is, it's actually this company called Codget. Well, what is the business that Codget is in? So when we go to Tower Records, we're not just being watched by Tower Records, but we're also being watched by this company called Codget, which is an internet marketing company. So if we head off to Codget and go to their homepage, I guess folks are using Napster. It's a little bit slow here bringing up stuff. You will see that they're an internet marketing company, and what they say is they're able, even if somebody just walks into your store for the first time, they're able to provide information about that person so that you can know whether it's, the gender of the person, their age, these sorts of things. And the way that this works is that Codget runs a network of websites. And when we buy something from, say, Tower or another member of this network, the members provide your name and address to Codget. Then Codget, in turn, goes and buys data about you from a company called Equifax, who has 110 million profiles of us from the offline world. Then this information is given back to Codget, and then they use this then at the different member websites to customize your view of the Internet. So in the case of something like Tower Records, they'll get information such as your zip code, your income, what kind of cars you drive, how many kids you have. And they use this information then to change your view of the Internet. Something like you go in the Tower Records store and they switch everything around just for you. Now we could say that's a good thing, that we're going to get stuff that matches up to what we need. But we're sort of in this very strange area now that I think is pretty unique of using information that changes fundamentally the media that we see, the information that presents it. Now, when I talked to the company at Kachet and asked them, you know, a little bit about how their system works, they did one thing they assured me of right away when they, you know, saw where I was coming from. They said, we don't use race or religious affiliation, but we'll use everything else we got. And they supposedly have 500 data points for each household, up to 500 data points for each household. So here we have this technology here on the internet with an application service provider providing this personalization to this website in a sort of very hidden manner. Now, if you go to the Tower Records privacy policy, where something like this should be disclosed, there's a long privacy policy, which, you know, probably lawyers would like to read, but I'm not sure the average consumer could understand. You go through here, and one of the questions is, you know, with whom does Tower Records share my information? And it says, Tower Records does not sell, trade, or rent your personal information to others. Well, that's not really true. They give your name. If you buy something from Tower Records, they hand off your name and address to Kajet. Now, if you go through here and you read further on, it goes, says, except Tower Records may share your personal information with our contractors to improve service to you, but only if the contractor agrees to keep such information confidential. Now, if I was a consumer, would I know that I'm being, you know, I can think, well, surely they got to give my name and address, say, to the credit card company so they can charge my credit card, and Federal Express or UPS might get my name and address to deliver a package. But is there somebody, you know, does Kajet sort of fall in this category of a contractor? And I think it's tough for a consumer to really know. Now, that's about it. There's no mention here of Kajet really in the privacy policy. Now, we go over to Kajet itself, where we have another privacy policy that covers that web bug, that hidden tracking device that's at the Tower Record site, and it describes in great detail about how the Kajet system works. And it does a nice job of explaining the technology. And it turns out it's written by somebody who's in the privacy business, I was told. So it makes sense that they're actually very open. But again, it's very technical, very difficult for the consumer to understand what's going on. But here's the question. How would a consumer, when they're at Tower Records, even know to come over here? And the answer is there's no way. Unless you know how to read source code, you can go to Network Solutions and look up ClickSafe to see who they really are, then you can come here. So it requires somebody with a lot of tech savvy to understand, you know, what's going on. So this gets in, later on there's going to be a session on notice, and I think this illustrates the problem of notice in a big way. That you have multiple people providing services at websites, and you have two different privacy policies, and there's no way to learn about the second privacy policy. Now, Kajet also offers an opt-out, the ability to say, hey, I want you to set a cookie on my computer that doesn't have a unique number, so Kajet, you can't track me. But again, there's no way for a consumer to know about this. There's no way at Tower Records that they tell you about this opt-out opportunity. You know, so on one hand, they can come in and say, you know, if Kajet had to testify before, you know, some lawyers at Congress, they could say, hey, we got this great opt-out. But it doesn't matter because there's nobody tells you about it. Now, Kajet did come up with a scheme of doing notification, and they have like a logo that you can put on your home page, and then they have a complete you know, boilerplate paragraph that you can drop into privacy policies. Now, they have approximately a few hundred websites where they plant web bugs to do monitoring, and I only found one. That's one website that uses this boilerplate language, and clearly Tower Records doesn't. And so there's a real issue here. There's a really disconnect between, you know, what they say and what they do. And I kind of find that a lot in looking at internet issues. So on one hand, they've got their sort of CYA language here. You know, here's the language that we'd like our customers to put in, but there's no contractual requirement for the websites to include this. And so I think that presents a real problem. Now, before we said, well, where does, you know, Kajet get the data about us? And I mentioned, I guess it's Experian. I'm actually going to have to, the data supplier is one of the big data collectors. But where do they get our data from? Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And that's another issue here of privacy, which is not talked about a lot, but the issue of public records, of a lot of the data that's being used to market to us in the direct marketing world is actually public records. Now, I live over in Brookline, which is across the river here, and our town, has done something nice here, which is to put all the tax records online. And that's not that unusual. A lot of towns are doing that. So you can simply go to the Town of Brookline's website, you know, type in a name or an address and get information about people's taxes. Well, I'm not going to show you my taxes, but I will show you Michael Dukakis's taxes. He happens to also live in Brookline here. So he's got, for Brookline, he's got a pretty average, probably the median average house. But, you know, we can say he pays $7,000 in taxes, which is, you know, for Massachusetts a lot, but we're a high, you know, kind of high tax state here. Not to embarrass Michael Dukakis, you can also, though, besides, you know, getting, you know, we could do this one at a time. That's pretty inefficient. But the Town of Brookline, in order to make it very easy to get this information by any commercial entity or by other people, have actually put the entire assessor database as a text file, which you can download and plug into Excel. So one of the primary ways that the offline direct marketers are getting data about us is through these kinds of public records. And it's even gone to one step further, is that the cities and towns are accommodating these people by making it very, very easy. And it's really anybody. You just go up to the website. This is a file that's on the Town of Brookline website. And you can get, you know, everybody's name and address, what they paid for their house, and what they pay in taxes. And having looked at some of the direct marketer databases about myself, this is the kind of data that's in here. This is a public record database. I think it makes a very interesting question here is information like this something that should be public records? You know, it's a very interesting question. And, you know, why should this information be used that when I go to the Tower Records website and then show me what records they want to sell to me? You know, why should that be being done? That's a sort of very interesting connection question. At least the Town of Brookline does, we have personal information about you, so we get into fair information practice, so they are providing access. I'm not sure they're providing the greatest security here because we can look at anybody's record, but in terms of access, we get to look at it. Another issue that I wanted to briefly talk about is, real quick here, is the NEI agreement, which I think will probably come up later today, and the issue of the network advertisers, you know, working on an agreement with the federal government through the Federal Trade Commission on how online profiling is to be done. Now, what's interesting is Cogent is not part of this agreement. They're not considered a network advertiser, even though they do a lot of the same kinds of services. But the NEI agreement was signed last July, and it's basically going in effect over the next over the first quarter of this year. What I'm at today here on the screen is their opt-out page. The ability, if a consumer doesn't want to participate in any kind of network advertising profiling, and go to this page. Now, one of the issues I have is I don't see the just do it button. You know, this is not too bad of an opt-out page in the sense that you have to go through here and individually click off each ad network to say I don't want to be profiled by them. And so I have some questions here about ease of use on opt-out. There should just be one like, hey, I don't want to participate at all. You hit that button, it should be at the top of the page. Another issue that I have real quick is lack of participation in the NAI agreement. And this is a letter that I put together to the NAI and also the FTC asking, well, here are 30 other companies who are in the network advertising business. Why are they not participating in the NAI agreement? When the press releases went out, it said it was 90% of the people in the network advertising business were participating. And I found pretty easily 30 people that weren't, clearly direct competitors to some of the members there. So I have this problem of sort of practice, you know, what's being said versus what the practice is. Let me go one last thing here. I'm running a little over time, so I'm going to do one quick thing on security, because I think security is always fun. Which is that's probably the most famous case of credit cards being stolen on the internet. A gentleman by the name of Maxis, who was 18 years old and lived somewhere in Eastern Europe or in Russia, stole 350,000 credit card numbers. And then he tried to extort $100,000 out of CD Universe in order to not release these credit card numbers. So what he did when they didn't pay up is he went through with his threat to go public with it, but he did it in a very clever way, which is he set up a website that when you went to it, it would give you out the credit card numbers that he stole. So you would go to this web page and you would click on the button that's in the middle of the screen here, and lo and behold, he would give you out a credit card number with name, address, and the credit cards. And I've changed some of the things here to protect the innocent. But he had the site running for about 2 weeks, and it came down once he went real public with it. And he was able to get away with his crime, as far as we know. The only thing that he got out of it was a front page story in the New York Times. But what this illustrates here is the issue of security, why it's so important. If we don't have security at our e-commerce websites, we're collecting all the data about people. If we don't have it, some really bad things can happen here, in the sense that we get identity fraud, and we get people's credit cards being used in ways they never ever expected. I got one more last demo, and then I'll stop here because I don't want to run too much over. Just a great story. I think that for next time you're doing research with search engines, I bet everybody in the room here one time or the other uses search engines, and it's something to consider. I did a search here for Cadillac lawsuits. So that's AltaVista. AltaVista is my favorite search engine. And you'll notice that at the top of the page, I'm getting a ad from Cadillac for 2002 Escalade. Okay. Well, it's not a coincidence. What's happened is Cadillac or General Motors has bought the Cadillac C word at AltaVista. And so anytime you type in Cadillac, there are banner ads going to show. Now, what's interesting, though, is that Cadillac has a special deal with a company called MatchLogic to show its ads. And they have a special server, and this information, this particular search string goes back to that server, and it's stored in the General Motors /MatchLogic server. So if you're sitting in an attorney general's office in some building, that information, the fact that you're doing research on General Motors is going back to General Motors. Is any time that a banner ad from General Motors is coming up. So that's something to consider next time that you're using a search engine to do legal research, that maybe the people you're doing research on are looking in. Now, I've asked a number of companies, and I know Chris Kelly's here from Excite, but I've asked a number of companies, well, what's being done with that information? Is there any kind of report being generated about what people are searching for? Because General Motors is in a unique position. Most banner ads go back to like a double click or something like this. You don't go back to a server that's actually owned by General Motors. So it's a very interesting question. This web is a little more complicated than we think. So thank you very much.
Danny Weissner sets up, let me just mention quickly a bit about him. He is the director of the World Wide Web Consortium Technology and Society Activities. So many of these social and legal issues that involve public policy debates, intellectual property, speech, privacy, and so on, are the matters with which he deals professionally. And as soon as he's wired, someday...
This is what most of my job is.
As a former teacher, it was the class in audio-visual material that we took, yes. We'll simplify this by having an implant at birth someday. Go ahead, Danny.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. And it's a pleasure to have this work so quickly. It's rare. Usually you have to come, as you all know, armed with a couple of jokes for while you're fiddling around with your laptop. But you're spared by jokes. You're lucky. I'm here to talk with all of you today about work that's been going on at the World Wide Web Consortium on a technology standard called the Platform for Privacy Preferences. And let me just give you a little bit of a picture of what I hope to accomplish in the next 15 minutes. I want to give a little bit of a view into what we in the web technology community view as some of the key privacy challenges that we faced and that we hope we could do something to address. Talk a little bit about the response that the technology community has had in the form of P3P, the Platform for Privacy Preferences. And I think, for all of our purposes here, in some sense, the critical question, which is a question that, that Richard started to raise, is what is the relationship between the various legal frameworks that we have in various states, in the U.S., around the world, the whole complex of legal and regulatory tools that we clearly have at our disposal, and the technology, various technologies that are available on the web and that will become available on the web. How can we think about all these different tools, legal and technological, working together to address privacy issues? I think it's sort of easy to want to pick one or the other and say we can fix everything with technology, or say we all we need is some good laws, or all we need is some good enforcement. And I hope that by the end of my talk I can persuade you that it takes some of both. And I want to then just conclude by talking about some of the next steps that we're taking at the World Wide Web Consortium to make this technology more widely available. So I think that if you look at the privacy issues that have really captivated the public mind over the last couple of years with respect to web privacy, what you see are a series of incidents, high profile, front page sort of stories, and I've just listed a couple here, that have really all been about, I believe, people sense that when they go on the web, they lose control of their personal information. That information is collected without their knowledge, and it's used in ways that they have no information about, much less any ability to control. And I think the kind of web bug technology that Richard's talking about is just the latest in a stream of these. That the fact is, the web is a complicated place, both technologically and from the standpoint of people's user experience. People don't understand what's happening, and as a result, they get nervous. Those of you who have been paying attention to this issue for a while will remember that for a number of years in the early stages of the web, there was significant concern about whether people would even be willing to put their credit card numbers on the web to purchase things. Obviously, people have gotten through that, but I would argue that they got through it because they developed some common sense understanding of the kind of protections that were available. When it comes to the collection of personal information, though, whether it was in the case of the ID number that was included on that is included on Intel CPUs, John Gage mentioned this earlier. That might be used somehow to track people's behavior, to verify people's purchases, et cetera, to give a more concrete sense of people's identity when they browse the web. That caused a huge stir because people had the sense, and the press picked up on the fact that people felt there was information about them that was very sensitive and personal being transferred in the background, as it were, without people's knowledge and without the ability to control it. The same kind of thing happened with respect to the Windows ID used in the office environment, that IDs that were unique to the Windows, the particular Windows operating system, were being attached to documents created with the Office application suite. That got a lot of people worried, A, because they didn't know that it was happening, B, because they didn't know what to do about it, to stop it or to control it. And then finally, all the attention that DoubleClick got when it tried to do, in fact, just about the same kind of ID matching that Kajib is now doing. Somehow they've flown under the radar screen a little bit better, so Richard has work to do. Again, speaks to the fact that there was information being collected, people didn't know it was happening, they didn't know what to do about it. So in looking at this situation nearly 3 years ago, the World Wide Web Consortium began a project, a technical standards project called the Platform for Privacy Preferences. And what we wanted to be able to do, first and foremost, was to use the power of this web technology to enhance the kind of notice, the kind of information that people had about what information was being collected about them, number one, and to enable people to make better, quicker and smarter choices about what kind of privacy relationships they wanted to enter into. We thought this was important, certainly to increase the level of trust that people have when they use the web, especially with personal information. And also we felt it was important to streamline e-commerce transactions. For the few people who do go and read privacy policies, or more people feel they have to go and read privacy policies, that does take away time from people browsing, shopping, buying, etc. Any of you who have done that know that it's a substantial discretion. So as much as there was an interest in the web industry in increasing notice, there was also a substantial interest in doing this in a way that didn't force people to choose between having this information they wanted, having this notice and making these choices, and doing what they actually went to the web to do. So we tried to do the best job we could in designing technology to meet those two goals. And finally, because the web is a technology that's used around the world across borders, and because the World Wide Web Consortium is an international standards body, we felt it was critical that whatever technology we came up with be able to address the wide range of privacy regulatory frameworks that there are, both in the U.S. and around the world. We were intent on not picking a single privacy regulatory framework as the one that was correct, because we would A, get it wrong, and B, get a lot of people upset with us, whichever one we chose. But we did really want to recognize and want to account for the fact that people who are doing business on the web know they're doing business in many jurisdictions, and in general want to comply with the laws of those jurisdictions, even if they're trying to change them at the same time. And secondly, that users understand, as they browse around, they're interacting with different websites from different countries governed by different legal regimes. So we wanted to create as common as possible, as seamless as possible, a privacy environment for both web users and web service providers. Just a little bit about the World Wide Web Consortium to give you a context for how we approach this work. We're the organization that sets the technical standards for the web, so we got our start in 1994. When the inventor of the web, Tim Berners-Lee, brought together a consortium of mostly technology companies to make sure that web technology would evolve in a way that it continued to meet the needs of the industry and that would combat the inevitable fragmentation that we have in technology as competitive forces come to bear. So we were trying to keep the technology dynamic on the one hand, but interoperable on the other hand. We have we're located here at MIT in Cambridge, and we have offices as well in France and Japan. We have at this point over 500 members, many of whom are from the computer industry, some of whom are here, and many others are from either the research community representing consumer organizations and others. So we have a relatively broad reach. Our main product is technical standards. And I think for this purpose it's important to distinguish between the technical standards that keep the web working together and the actual software that we all use in our day-to-day lives to relate to the web. So we do not develop software. Our members develop software according to our standards, but if they follow our standards, then what everyone can count on is the fact that a website created with anyone's web software will be able to be displayed and accessed through a browser or other technology written by anyone else. And I think that what we've succeeded in doing over the last 6-7 years of our existence, and I can only take credit for about 2 or 3, is that we have succeeded in creating a very vibrant and competitive market in web technology based on a set of common standards. So it's that perspective that we bring to working on the privacy question. We are not out there to develop the single killer privacy application. What we are out to do is to establish a common framework by which all different sorts of web applications and web services can communicate about privacy, and through which consumers can expect a common experience of privacy. Let me give just a very quick view of what P3P enables. P3P, really from a consumer standpoint, has three critical functions. The first is that P3P provides a standard kind of notice about sites' privacy practices. And in many ways, this was the hardest thing that we had to do, was that we had to develop a common language for talking about the way websites handle personal information. We were lucky because we actually had a lot of very solid work from privacy regulators all around the world, starting with work done in the U.S. Federal Privacy Act, and on through the European Data Protection Directive, the OECD privacy guidelines. We were able to look at lots of different well thought through approaches to the general handling of personal information. And what we came up with was a vocabulary which is reduced in technical terms to a set of XML elements. XML is a version of the language that all web pages are written in. So what we did was we took privacy and reduced it to the language of the web, and most importantly, to a language that web browsers and other web software can actually work with. What can then happen is people who use the web in a P3P-enabled environment can establish for themselves what their privacy preferences are, and they can rely on their software to compare their preferences with the privacy practices of a particular website. You'll see in some later slides how this might look to the user. Again, because we're developing a technology standard and not software, we didn't say what it should actually look like on the screen, but what we did try to do was to make sure that when people establish for themselves privacy preferences, they had a way to compare them against the privacy practices of any website out there. Finally, we built into P3P the ability to talk about privacy assurances, and by that I mean statements that a website might make about who offers assurance or who verifies or who certifies their privacy policy. So that might be the state of New York. The state of New York might decide to go and check lots of different privacy policies and issue seals of approval for them. The European Commission or individual data protection commissioners might decide to go and do this. Or trustee or BBB Online already do a very similar kind of thing. To one degree or another, those private assurance organizations, from a self-regulatory perspective, look at the privacy policies of their members or their licensees, depending on who they are, and they assess to one degree or another, with varying methodologies, the degree to which the site actually follows its policy, the degree to which the site's policy is adequate according to some measure or another. And we give consumers a way to check that the sites that they're visiting that they want to do business with have actually been certified by a particular organization that they trust. So those are the three main functions of P3P. Here's a very sketchy little image of what a P3P interaction might look like. So you have a user who's sitting operating a web browser over here on the left, and then you have a web service over on the right in purple, I guess that is, with a privacy policy. The user over here has privacy preferences. When the user first visits the website, the first thing that happens in most cases before any personal information is transferred at all is that the website sends the user's browser or other software the user is working through an indication of that website's privacy policy. Then the user's browser is going to compare his or her privacy preferences with the site's policy and make a choice about whether that user wants to continue the interaction or not, or go and do something else. It's important here that we keep the privacy preferences on the user's side. So the user doesn't have to go and tell lots of websites what his or her preferences are. The user keeps those private, and in fact we've provided in the specification that in this initial interaction when a browser is checking the privacy policy of a website, there should be no collection of personal information at all until the user has had a chance to decide to continue with that site. And then if the user makes a choice to continue, personal information may be transferred. I want to race through a little bit here. We're at the stage now with P3P where the technology specification that defines P3P is finished. It's going through some final reviews, but the design is finished. So we're at the point now where we are looking for and actively encouraging implementations. For P3P to work, implementation has to happen fundamentally in two places. First of all, websites have to implement P3P. Websites have to take the privacy policy, which they have hopefully already developed, and translate it into the P3P vocabulary. This does not involve, we hope, any legal judgment, any new decisions about what a site's privacy policy is. It is simply a translation of a legally defined policy into one that fits the P3P vocabulary. And then web software of various types has to implement P3P. Most importantly, obviously, are the web browsers. That's the way most of us interact with the web. We have concrete implementation commitments from AOL Netscape and from Microsoft. I think you've got someone tomorrow who's going to probably talk a little bit more about Microsoft's plans here. But what Microsoft has said is that the next version of Internet Explorer, their browser, that is version 6, will include P3P compliant cookie management, and the last I heard, that's expected to be released in July. That's also going to be the standard browser that's included in the next release of the Microsoft operating system coming out a couple months later. So we're on a track now where pretty soon, in less than a year, lots of people who use the web for all kinds of reasons will have P3P capabilities built into their browsers. Servers have to implement P3P to make it easier for websites to describe their privacy policies in P3P. We've seen in early stages a number of browser plugins, that is little pieces of software that you can add on to your existing browser in some sense to upgrade it for P3P. And we've seen interest and commitments from data mining companies and customer relationship management software companies who have responsibility on the back end, as it were, for handling personal information, for handling customer information. And what they're looking at is ways to make sure that once a website declares its privacy policy in P3P, that as that information is processed through the whatever chain it's processed and shared with whatever other organizations it's shared, that we can use the P3P vocabulary against which to check that the personal information is handled as advertised. There are a number of sites that have already become P3P compliant. Everyone from AOL and AT&T and Engage and IBM and the White House and some smaller ones. And this is a small list here. I want to just show you very quickly an example of how P3P might look. Remember, the goal here is really to integrate this privacy control technology as part of people's browsing experience. We don't want people to have to go follow the link that says read my privacy policy and have them go spend 5 minutes doing that and fumble through and decipher things that I think only Richard Smith and some other people in this room can decipher. What we want it to be is we want privacy to be part of the view that people have normally of the web. So here's happens to be a screenshot of a plugin from a company called iDecide, which added up to the top at the top of the browser border there, an indication that tells the user something about the P3P policy. In this case, what this browser found was that it found a P3P policy, but it found, as this dialog box indicates, that the site does not match something about the user's preferences, specifically that the site shares personal information with others. This is an early implementation of P3P, but it gives you some idea. Here's some other ways, some other kinds of indications that we might see with P3P. Up on the top left is an indication that there was no P3P policy at all. Down on the bottom, the bottom right, there's an indication that the P3P policy was acceptable. Now, in reality, I don't really expect many consumers to go around saying, I'm wondering about P3P. In the same way that most people who use the web don't go around wondering about HTML or HTTP or the technologies that make the web work. we're certainly expecting that what people are going to be thinking about is privacy and their personal information, not the names of technical standards from organizations like W3C. As much as we would like the attention, we're not really expecting that people are going to know this. But what we are expecting is that everyone who builds things for the web will use this standard so that browsers can provide this additional information. Here's a quick example of a piece of software that's available free from IBM. It's called the P3P Policy Editor. And this allows, in a menu-driven, graphical user interface style, any webmaster to translate the website's privacy policy into P3P. And you'll see there are a variety of different questions and choices that the webmaster has to answer. And then down here on the bottom is the actual P3P data itself. Users hopefully are never going to see that sort of stuff. But this is a tool that any webmaster can use very easily to make their site P3P compliant. I want to just close with one quick note. A colleague of mine named Alexander Dix, who's a data protection commissioner from Germany, said P3P is necessary but not sufficient for privacy protection. And for whatever any of us may think pro or con about European data protection approaches, I think that he really hit something. I believe that P3P is necessary because regardless of the kind of statutory framework that we have, if we adopted wholesale in the United States the European Data Protection Directive, and if all of you and all of your offices spent nothing but doing data protection enforcement under that statute, I believe we still need P3P. And the reason is because on the web, people are confronted with a huge number of privacy choices, day by day, minute by minute. One day it's Kajit's web bug, another day it's something else. And for all the different websites people visit, they have to make choices. Many people and many privacy advocates spend a lot of time making sure that consumers have the right to make choices and that consumers have the right to believe that those choices can be enforced. And I think that's certainly important. But if we don't give consumers reasonable mechanisms with which to make choices, they're not going to do it. This is what we know from the web, is that things that are hard to do that get in the way of what people want to really do, which is go and buy the CD or find information about John Zittrain or whatever else it is. They're simply, I believe, and I think experience shows, going to bypass the choices and all the legal protections that we may afford them. So P3P enables people to make well-informed choices within whatever legal bounds in whatever communities we're in whatever jurisdictions we're in, have decided are the appropriate ones. It is certainly, I think, not sufficient. All you have to look at and see that P3P only addresses two of the four Federal Trade Commission suggested fair information practices. It doesn't address security. It does not address enforcement. It helps with enforcement potentially, but it doesn't address it. So P3P is not the entire answer here. But I think that it really is a critical component here. Just to give you a very quick picture of where we're going from here at W3C, certainly we are looking very closely for deployment in all of the major browsers. We are, over the next 6 months, going to be targeting P3P compliance at the top 100 websites. All of you, I'm sure, have seen the surveys that indicate what a large percentage of time most of the public spend at the top 100, if not the top 50 sites. So we are going to be working very hard to encourage those sites with the kind of tools that I showed you and with education campaigns to make sure that those sites are in fact P3P compliant. We are also going to be working very hard on consumer education to make sure that the choices that people have through P3P are actually useful for them and they actually understand they have them. This is where, frankly, we really could use your help. We're committed to not having the web be another blinking VCR phenomenon. I think it's critical, and I think, frankly, people have no choice but to learn how to make these choices. No amount of law or regulation is going to provide perfect protection for people. These sorts of tools, I think, are a critical component, but people do have to understand that they're there and have to understand the importance of using them. So sorry for running over, and I don't know if we have a little bit of question time, but thanks very much. Yeah. There is no default specified in the technology specification. Each individual implementer will be making choices about defaults in one way or the other. I can report what Microsoft has said the IE default will be, and as of now, I'm not their spokesperson, and I don't know that this is what the final product will be. What they have been looking at, I gather, is a default that would allow the placement of third-party cookies only if the cookie has associated with it a P3P policy and if that P3P policy provides at least for an opt-out. So but I think you've asked the hardest question. I know that everyone who's developing P3P software is sweating over this one because it's a hard set of choices. And I think that there'll be different approaches taken. Yeah. The default can actually be set at a variety of levels. I think in practice it's going to be the browser designer who makes the choices about default. One of the features that we've included in P3P is the ability to, in some sense, share privacy preferences. So I think that lots of people feel that asking the average consumer to make a huge long list of choices about what their preferences are may be too burdensome. We provided a way to create packages of preferences that may come with the recommendation of a particular organization or a particular individual. So the Privacy Foundation could distribute a set of P3P preferences and say, this is what Richard Smith thinks how you should browse the web. And you can, with essentially one click, install those preferences. Other organizations could do the same. Well, there were a couple of considerations that went into that. Number one, there are security standards for the internet and the web already, and there are large groups of people who work on that. So there's the SSL security that provides SSL security that is the normal security that you see with credit card forms on the web that collect credit card numbers. We didn't feel that we wanted to duplicate that or provide any kind of a competing alternative. And frankly, I think that there are certainly a large number of unresolved security issues on the web, many of which are the kinds of things I think that Richard pointed to, the back-end security, the ability to really follow through on security beyond just the point where a customer puts in his or her credit card number, but to make sure that the handling of that information is done correctly. We frankly did not think that was an appropriate subject for our own standards making effort. It's not to say that someone shouldn't do it, or lots of someone shouldn't do it, but it wasn't within the scope of what we thought we could accomplish. You're asking, I think, about audits and verification, audit trails at least, of these sorts of interactions. That is certainly work that we've been talking about. I think we'd need help from some of you to get that right, frankly. Those are difficult design problems, as you know, and they're mostly not even technical design problems. They're mostly things for accountants and auditors to work on. It's certainly something that we could look at in the future, and there's been interest in it. Again, we wanted to try to bite off the first chunk that we thought we could make progress on, but certainly extensions in the areas that you're talking about are things that we could think about. And the input that would be valuable is certainly helpful for us.
One last comment.
They're designed to do that. I think that there is certainly, you know, all I can say is that I think that we certainly plan to look very closely at how people actually use this privacy vocabulary to build up a little bit of a kind of a quasi case law around it, if you will, and try to see where people are using these terms in consistent ways and where there are divergences. That'll certainly inform our ongoing efforts to evolve the vocabulary. So we've tried to be as precise as we possibly can. There are some inherent imprecisions that people with good faith will run into, no doubt, and that's going to be part of what we will have to be looking at on an ongoing basis. But we are going to keep track of it, at least to try to spot cases where there are these kinds of gaps.
Danny, thank you very much for your participation and the update.
Okay.
Elliot Spitzer.
Good morning. The good news is this is the last class before lunch. I remember as a student sitting here, I was always very conscious of that and watched the clock a bit more carefully. During those last classes, we'll try to keep to the appointed hour. You can see we're also a little bit retro. We don't want to use all the high-tech stuff. We thought we'd remind you what it was like a few years ago, where having nicely printed letters on a piece of fiberboard was considered high-tech. Certainly for those of us who were trying cases a decade ago, this was considered as good as you could get. I want to pick up just briefly on one or two of the things that were said this morning about the ubiquity of the Internet and information technology. It was driven home to me last December. I went down to Costa Rica with my wife and three daughters. We wanted to experience something totally different, see a completely different lifestyle. We were deep in the rainforest in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and the housing stock, such as it existed, was, of course, very different than what we're used to seeing anywhere in the United States, regardless of economic strata. And there we were bumping along in some sort of vehicle buried in the rainforest, and there was a hut, and I thought my kids would appreciate how different the world looked. But there was one mysterious thing. On top of this little hut that barely qualified to be called a hut, there was a satellite dish. And in front of this hut, there was somebody pecking away at a laptop that appeared to be hooked up. It was a wireless internet access. And so there we were in the middle of nowhere, and this fellow was hooked into, he may have been trading his portfolio akin to one of those online trading company ads that we used to see until they all disappeared, or most of them disappeared. So the ubiquity of this technology is absolutely irrepressible, and it continues to expand exponentially. There's no question it is taking over every corner of the world. I also want to pick up on something that Hiawatha Gray said, that I was flattered. I think those of us who are here who are lawyers were flattered when he said that really the lawyers are the more important group as opposed to the technical people. And it was nice to think that we'd made the right choice a couple years back in terms of our professional careers, but I'm not sure he's right. And the reason, although I think he may be right in the long term, at the end of the day, the rules and the laws that we create to dictate how interactions occur in this sector will be finally dispositive. What we're dealing with right now is a dynamic process, and I think John Zittrain explained it. His first chart, where he began with the Gutenberg press and then the Xerox machine and then the internet, what was really most remarkable about that was the acceleration in time between mega technological developments. It took a few hundred years to go from the Gutenberg press to the Xerox machine. Then the Xerox machine to the internet was only a couple years, and if you listen to John Gage describe what may be the next generation of technical capacity, these things are emerging at breakneck speed. We on the legal side are stuck in a debate that is relatively static. And we have not met, in this dynamic process, we have not met the challenge of calibrating and changing our laws as quickly as the technical folks are asking us to do so. And the consequence is that in these intervening periods, this sort of interstitial period where you have new technologies but an inapplicable legal structure, all sorts of stuff happens. It may be good, it may be bad, but nonetheless, that is the period when Napster is out there without any clear legal definition about what the rules are. And it's during those periods that there can be, depending how you see it, either great advantages for economic efficiency before the law intervenes inappropriately, or if you take the other side, tremendous threats to privacy because we don't have the capacity to control how information flows. So I think although Hiawatha may be right, that at the end of the day, we will come up with a legal framework that works. It's until we get there that we're facing a real challenge, and that is really our, I think, our, the threat that we face. And I think we're going to be discussing notice and choice for a little bit of time here. The problem is we've been discussing notice and choice for a couple years, and by the time we resolve it, it may be irrelevant. And that, I think, is what we, as lawyers, as policymakers, AGs, whatever our role here, we need to understand that tension and come to grips with the need for speed as well as the need to get it right. Well, let me briefly introduce the folks who are on this panel, and then I will try to just play just a small role pushing the discussion forward. Jill Lesser, who is a senior VP at AOL Time Warner, and AOL Time Warner, I think when we were all at Stanford, it was that day that we read in the newspapers that you guys were going to be created, and so I guess here you are. It was also that day, you may remember, I think it was that day that the issue of Maxis and this the threat to release all the credit cards was on the front page. I think it was sort of an interesting moment, two major issues that were breaking right then. To Jill's left is Jean Ann Fox, whom I think most of us know from the Consumer Federation of America, a self-described consumer protection advocate, and it'll be interesting to see if everybody is willing to concede that point to her. Mallory Duncan, who is the Vice President General Counsel of the National Retail Federation. I'm hoping you will disagree vigorously with everything Gene says. And then to his left, Scott Cooper, who's from Hewlett-Packard, that is trying definitely to balance itself in the middle here. So try to make yourself interesting, even though you're going to try to be too politic. What you see in front here, and we're going to do this pretty quickly to move the discussion forward, is a policy, privacy policy of a company, fictitious, the Acme Company. I hope you can all read it. And the first question I want to ask, and I'll ask, Mallory, I'll ask you this one. Should, if Acme is your client, should they even put this policy out, and why?
I actually, unfortunately, being a lawyer, the answer is it depends.
That's no fun. The next.
If Acme is purely an online company, then perhaps it's a good idea for them to put the policy up, and there are a number of benefits we talked about this morning. But if Acme, novelty company, also has a brick-and-mortar base or a catalog operation, then I'd have real reservations about them going forward with the policy.
You're
going
to discriminate. If I buy online, I'm better off than if I buy offline.
Actually, I think we always try to have a singular look at the customer. We want to know you.
So you're going to dumb us down to the worst common denominator.
The lowest common denominator.
If you have one little retail store, you're not going to put this policy up because you don't want to. You're going to hide behind protecting the guy who walks in. You won't protect anybody.
You're perhaps overstating it, but that's right. If you think about it, how it worked in the retail environment for 100 years. When your grandmother went into a dry goods store, she walked in. The guy said to her, here's the fabric, the flour, the sugar you're going to purchase.
But 100 years ago, they didn't keep a computer database of everything she bought.
But he had a better source. He memorized every single thing that she bought there.
Did
and when she
it?
Came back, he reminded her about
did
it.
Did he sell it?
He sold it. He sold it. If she came in and kept a weekly, a ledger, and she paid it or didn't pay it,
right.
He probably kept a note of that, but he also probably told Frank the butcher that, watch out
so
for the Joneses.
Gene, do you buy this? You buy the notion that just because they have a little, brick and mortar outlet as well, therefore their online company shouldn't have this?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. We do take the position that consumers should have fairly consistent privacy protections, whether they're doing business online or offline. With convergence, it's very difficult to draw distinctions between exactly where a consumer is. We believe that there should be privacy policies posted for every commercial website to which consumers go, but that those policies should actually protect consumers' privacy and should meet the basic eight fair information practices that have been spelled out in a lot of venues. And in the fancy written speech that I did for you, which I will email to all of you, you can find links to all of that
right.
information. But we believe that you need a privacy policy. Unfortunately,
even if it's just a bricks and mortar company.
Sure, bricks and mortar companies should tell customers what they're doing with their information, especially the supermarkets that have the frequent shopper cards and are tracking people. Unfortunately, your example meets maybe one and a half of eight fair information practices. So this one isn't worth posting.
Okay, but for a different reason.
Yes.
Jill, now AOL, Time Warner, you are ubiquitous. You're everywhere. You sell to us in every way possible. Would you post a policy if not this one?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. I think I really disagree with Mallory, although we probably have to dig deep into the details to know just how much. I think that all consumers have a right to know what we are doing with their information, because that's what they demand, that's what the marketplace demands. It is the question as to whether or not you would post this policy, I think, gets more into how do you communicate with your customers in different media. Is it the same? You may have a general commitment to, for example, a set of principles like notice and choice, but whether you're sending them magazines, communicating with them online through an online service, or providing them services through a website, or a variety of other offline outlets, obviously the communication mechanism, the degree to which you need to give consumers notice on an ongoing basis will shift, but it shifts because of the difference in the way you're transacting with consumers. So the question about whether you should be notifying your consumers of what you're doing with the information, I think unequivocally is yes, whether it's posting a privacy policy and how, and what challenges exist, for example, in a retail environment, is I think a different question.
Is anybody going to take the position, don't post anything because all you do is create legal liability? No policy, harder to make a case against it?
I guess I will come close to that position.
I thought I could draw you out.
let me back up just for a second here. A lot of the fair information practices that we're talking about now arise from a fundamental flaw. And the fundamental flaw is that the information out there belongs to the customer. But when Mrs. Jones goes into Mr. Smith's store to shop, two people are parties to that transaction. And two people know that Mrs. Jones shopped, and two people know what it is she bought. And for us to establish policies that are based on her controlling what he does with the information he knows creates suboptimal results later on that create very serious problems.
So you're saying both parties have a property right in it?
Exactly right.
Okay, so you just made an important concession, though. It's partly my property right, then shouldn't I be compensated when you use it?
It would be no more
property right whose character we haven't yet defined.
Let's take it out of an economic function. If two individuals in this room decide to have consensual sex, both of them know their parties had that practice, both of them know what goes on, and yet either one of them have a right.
You
said keep us moving here. Does either one of them have a right to control what the other says about it? I mean, there are obviously social norms that involve, and if one person talks too freely, he may be considered a cad, and they find that he has fewer opportunities in the future for such relations. But there's something here beyond economics driving this.
Fair point. All right, now let's move this forward a little bit. We're gonna play on that one a little bit later. But Scott, let's say misguidedly, but nonetheless, you've done it. Your company posts this policy, and it has warts and all, as Gene pointed out. It's the best, de minimis protection. Scott, let's say your company then wants to change its policy. How does it do it? And what notice does it have to give, and to whom?
Well, I think it comes down to the question of sort of where you draw these lines, and looking through your sheet over the weekend, I realized that you can make a good case along any long lines of this continuum as to where that bright line should be. I think for a company like ours, we would say that if we did change our policy, we would have to go back and notify everybody individually.
Let's say you change your policy. And you've had this policy on day one, but your new policy says, you know what, we take Mallory's point of view, this is our property, and we will feel free to sell it to anybody whom we want. Is merely sending an email to your prior customers sufficient, or do you have to now get them to opt in to accept this change?
I think to use the old information would have to be an opt-in, and that is actually our policy at HP. I think, though, going back to the original statement, and not as a lawyer, there's probably a lot of loopholes that I can't discover. I would say that this is not a bad place to start, where you put yourself on record as saying, here's what we do with our policy. Now, I'm not too sure how you define affiliate here, whether that's a term of art or not, But I think that by stating here is what we do, and do it in a clear and conspicuous way, I think that's key. It has to be clear, it has to be conspicuous. There is a legal liability through Section 5 authority of the FCC Act for having done that. What I'd like to see on here, I think, would be also a clear and conspicuous opt-out policy. In other words, so that if somebody disagrees with this, rather than 3 pages in or 4 pages over, right there is an opt-out that they can click and no harm, no foul. So I think it's the two pieces have to be joined. And I think Richard Smith was getting at that, where you have to have it clear. You also have to have, so you know who your affiliates, you know where the information is going. And also, if you disagree with that, you have to be able to get out of that as easily as possible.
Mallory, what is your view? Let's say you change your policy. Let's say you have this one on day one, and then you have a much more open sharing policy or sale policy, something that clearly states it's your property. What notice do you then have to give?
I do believe you have to give some notice for the reason Scott mentioned. You have essentially established a contract with those customers up to that point. The question is, what limitations are there on you going forward? We could take a very sort of extreme view and say you must try to seek out those customers, ask them, give them a chance to opt out and not pass the information on going forward. Or you could say that it's merely a notice provision. That is, you provide the notice and that is made forward.
You just state a choice. Which would you go for?
Well, here we go beyond law, and we go really get into questions of social policy.
It's a legal question. I mean, somebody's going to sue you.
That's right.
Look, you have a room full of AGs who love headlines, and I can say that because I'm one of them. And somebody's going to sue you, and somebody's going to say, wait a minute, you put in a new policy, you sent out an email, nobody read it, you didn't give us a chance to either opt in or what I think is right, opt out, or what I think is correct, which is to opt in, and now you're selling my information to the ABC company.
And I guess the question I would ask the people in the room is, how do you want the law to develop? Because if you decide that you're going to sue them for changing the policy, then people's response will simply be not to post policies, and we've taken a tremendous step back. If you say, as long as you make a concerted effort to tell people about the change, then you're home free, we're probably going to encourage more people to put policies up in the first place.
How does Time Warner deal with this? Has your privacy policy been uniform throughout?
It is not uniform throughout, but let me say this, because I think it gets back to something that you said when you started this panel, which is that I don't think that the practices of businesses vis-a-vis privacy and the use of information is really being driven, nor should it be driven by the law. So when you say, we haven't moved quickly enough with the technology, I actually think that's the exact opposite, which is that when we first started looking at this issue, when I joined the company, we had our first privacy policy nearly 5 years ago. It was buried in our terms of service. It was a very legalistic, very non-consumer friendly document. Over the years, and that's for the AOL core service, that policy has shifted significantly to be principle-based, much more consumer friendly, easy to access, always viewed during the registration process, not because attorneys general or policymakers are putting pressure on us, but because as we engage in the dialogue with our consumers about how to grow the business and how to make consumers comfortable with using the online environment, that's the way we had to move in terms of the use of personal information. So that the back and forth. So in answer to your question about Time Warner, the entire company is committed to a set of principles, notice and choice, and each division implements those principles differently depending upon the business they're in. So if you're at Warner Brothers and you're talking about a website policy, or Netscape, if you're within Time Inc. and you're delivering magazines through the mail, or if you're within AOL, the core service, you're going to have a different policy, but you're always going to have notice and choice. And I think what that ultimately comes down to is whether or not, and I know this is later in your hypothetical, is we're also therefore treating the sharing of information between those divisions or different businesses as sharing with third parties. Because we think from a consumer expectation standpoint, yes, if you subscribe to People Magazine, you have a level of expectation over time that you're going to get a solicitation for Time Magazine, but you don't necessarily have that level of expectation you'll get a solicitation from AOL, so that at least if it's clear that in order to make that solicitation you will have had notice and choice, it marries the consumer expectation with what we're trying to accomplish.
Gene, how do you feel about this, where somebody wants to lower the threshold for disclosure? What should the company do?
We think that the appropriate standard here is consent, not choice, to start with, and that consumers should be given the right to opt into use of their information is given for one purpose that a company wants to use for a second purpose. I would think you'd be into unfair trade practice realm here. If a company collected information under one set of promises to you and then switched their promise to a lower level of privacy protection, if that's what's going on here, I would think that would be something that you all would take very seriously and that they should not do.
You're certainly ratcheting it down poses different problems. But let me ask you a question. I mean, I think didn't Mallory have a point before 50 years ago? You'd go to the store, you'd go to the butcher, you'd buy slab of beef and to cook out over the weekend, and there was nothing that prevented that butcher from going to some other vendor in the city, in the town, to say, hey, you know what, I sold Ms. Fox X, Y, or Z. We didn't request opt-ins in that context, so why do we now?
The level of individualized data collection is so much greater under the electronic commerce model and the computerization of information that the information you can collect about me, his guy at the cash register couldn't remember everything I bought every week. We're a long way from the corner butcher can remember everything that you buy and remembers to go tell it to another
person. It's not a fair analogy.
It's not a fair analogy. And if a person followed you around in a shopping center, writing down every show window you looked in, every item you picked up, how long you fingered the silk, everything about that, you would take your umbrella to that person who would say, get away from me.
Right.
You're stalking me, you're snooping on me. When it happens invisibly online, many consumers don't know it, and they have no control over the uses that information is put to, and the level of privacy protection that we need as a matter of law is much greater.
How do you deal with the merger? Let's say you have two companies like AOL and Time Warner who mysteriously decide they can do better together, and they have different privacy policies. Who wins, who loses, what do you do in that context, and what do you do with consumers of one company who suddenly find themselves doing business with an integrated company that has one privacy policy that may be less restrictive? And does the company, the new entity, the surviving company, have to segregate the data and somehow say with customer one, this was the contract we had formed, with customer two, we had to have a different, had a practical way to proceed?
I don't know the practicalities of it, but I would think that you would have to get consent to use information collected under one set of terms in the future, even when a company merges. The method you go through to do that, I'm not a company person, I don't know how they would do that, but I would think it's an important thing to do, and you wouldn't want to start off a merged company with front page stories in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and carrying on chat rooms about how this new company is not going to treat its customers correctly.
Scott, how do you feel about that? You merge Hewlett-Packard, become Hewlett-Packard IBM, and suddenly you have different policies.
You'd probably have to ask IBM about that. I would say, just speaking, having never had to deal with that issue inside the company, speaking from where I think we would be that you would probably have a segregation of the two databases up until that point, probably require, as we're trying to move internally in HP, to an opt-in wherever we can. We don't know if we're going to succeed in every place, but we're trying to get there. I think when you merge like that, probably the understanding would have to be on both sides, that you'd have to have an opt-in for data sharing on that. But I think you could then start with that merged company probably back to an opt-out with a new policy with the understanding of any future information would then be an opt-out
this
situation.
This is going to look like a maze pretty soon.
Well, this is going to be the problem, I think, all along the lines when you come up, and certainly I think it's very graphic with sort of your three pages of sort of the continuum and sort of the what ifs in each case, that it's very easy to come either to we need a single law that answers all problems, and as H.L. Mencken said, usually the complex problems discovers simple solution, but it's usually the wrong solution. The other one, I think, which I worry coming from, I think, some of the industry, is that you can't get there from here. That things are too complicated, therefore we're going to let the marketplace kind of resolve these things over time. I think there are things you can do. They may seem incremental, but I think that's what you start, and then you move on from there. Where what we have supported for the last couple of years is clear and conspicuous disclosure, and we think that the key there is clear and conspicuous. That you can't just have a policy and then have to wade through it. It has to be something that you can immediately find. We also think the opt-out has to be clear and conspicuous as well. If you did that for the online environment, and perhaps you could even say that you have the obligation to find ways of in a converging environment to have that in the future, try to work it for the offline as well. But deal with the online at the beginning. I think that would make a major difference in sort of the debate you would have. If everybody understood you had to have a clear and conspicuous disclosure and you had to have a clear and conspicuous opt-out, we could get beyond that argument, because I think everybody ultimately could agree with that, and then we could have the debate. We should have done that 2 years ago. We should have done that 3 years ago. This would be a much different debate then than I think we're having now.
Joe, let me ask you, you've been through this. Have you handled a context where you have different privacy policies that suddenly are under the umbrella of one company?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to answer this question for all companies. You know, we at AOL Time Warner are and intend to continue to run our businesses really as separate core businesses, so that Warner Brothers will do what it does best and AOL will do what it does best. And so I think for us, we are not really facing this issue with the exception of certain synergies. And as we think about how we can exploit synergies, so for example, can a magazine renewal be offered over AOL? We go back to the original privacy policy under which that person's information was collected and determine whether or not they've been given the right notice and the right choices for us to be able to do that. So you sort of begin to figure out, in our case, how to exploit the synergies across brands and frankly test it out with consumers, all the while I think knowing that if you have made certain promises to your consumers in your privacy policy, you really do have to respect them. And so, for example, in your merger question, do you begin to see a standard new section in privacy policies that relates to either merger or bankruptcy, because we've seen a couple of these cases. And I think that's the way business has been evolving, so that you begin with a privacy policy. You might begin with a privacy policy like this. I think you quickly understand, frankly, more through consumer questions, which is, gee, I read your privacy policy. I have no idea what you're going to do with my information based on this privacy policy. You then go back to the drawing board and say, well, okay, where is it that we can be more clear and what are our consumers demanding? So I think it depends on the merger, but I certainly agree that when you make a promise to your consumer, you have to retain that promise in a merger context or a bankruptcy context.
No.
Just, you know, fundamentally, all of this comes back to, rather than fair information practices, it all comes back to consumer expectations. There are certain activities that companies have engaged in for years that people are aware of. For example, you know if you go to a magazine and you order it, that list is going to be sold, and you'll get solicitations from other magazines. What you may not expect is that if you subscribe to Cigar Aficionado, that they're going to sell that to Aetna Health Insurance Company, for example.
Well, that is a good segue. Let me cut you off just for a second. Let's fast forward 6 months. Sandy Weill hasn't bought anything over $10 billion in a week, so he's going to buy Aetna next week, right? He buys Aetna, and then another week goes by, he says, you know, I don't have too much cash sitting around in my pocket. I'm going to buy AOL Time Warner, stock's way down. Maybe it will make money someday, so I'm going to buy it. And what you then have under
a tough crowd here.
you then have under this one umbrella, literally the Travelers umbrella, you have AOL, Aetna, Time Warner, Citigroup. They're all affiliates.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your view that this information should go back free and clear among all these groups? And if not, why not? Scott, you just go down the row here.
Well, I think that there's going to be generic privacy legislation. I think, and also, though, we've already seen it in certain industries because of the importance of personal information, children's, classic, financial services, and medical, there's probably going to be a higher standard, and is a higher standard, in all three. So I think that you will probably have some sort of firewall built into, you know, the mega merger that you're talking about that would be very understandable, I think, from the policy side.
Firewall sure. Built in by whom?
Hopefully the feds.
Oh, but Congo, come on. You know they're not doing anything. All the companies are down in Washington saying don't do anything. You don't need anything. They're down up in every state capital saying don't do anything here because they're going to do it in Washington.
Well, actually,
I mean, it's a classic divide in Congress,
yeah.
Right?
Well, actually, I mean, you've got two companies here, AOL and HP, that testified last year in favor of the McCain-Kerry bill. Now, that allowed...
But that just put up the front of the good guy companies. Everybody else is out there. Yeah.
Well, I have to say it was a little bit lonely out there, but I think there's a lot more companies now that are in that position. I think we will see legislation this Congress. We need legislation. There's no question about that.
But if you don't have it, let's say we take the current legal framework, right, where affiliate sharing of information is specifically permitted. Is there going to be a free flow from Aetna to AOL to Citigroup? so that I want to borrow from Citigroup. They're going to know my health history. They're going to know what magazines I buy. Well, everything else.
There are probably loopholes. There are no doubt loopholes. But you certainly have within the HHS rules and regulations will be coming out certain limitations on the use of that information. You also have with certain loopholes limitations within the Graham-Leach-Bliley financial services. You certainly have limitations within COFA, which is the children's privacy. So you've got the beginning, hopefully, of some firewalls there. Are they perfect? No, but I don't think that you then walk away from it and say, well, it's not going to work, or we need the ultimate draconian solution. I think you have to be incremental in these areas because things will always change on you. And if you say, circa 2001, we have the answer, and you come back a couple of years, and this is what happened, I think, to the European privacy directors. They discover it. Well, no, the world has changed on them, and all these solutions that looked so perfect 2 years ago no longer work in the real world. So I think we've got to be very careful about coming up with the right solution in these things and finding out later that we've kind of nailed ourselves down into a problem.
Mallory, what's your view? Can that new entity share information across the board?
I think it really it's determined by what the consumers know. The whole debate over privacy is about a debate about changing expectations. If when they went in, they knew the company was an affiliate structure, for example, the JCPenney family of companies, the JCPenney life insurance, the JCPenney stores, the catalog, et cetera. If they knew that going in and knew that, then the idea that the information might be shared is not surprising.
Okay, well,
on the other hand,
when I was three, 38 years ago, I set up a savings account at what was then Chase Manhattan Bank, which is now this is Citibank, which is now the Citigroup. I put in $5. I had absolutely no understanding of what was coming down the road. So now, here we are 38 years later, can all my information be shared? Is it fair game?
I think that's what I was trying to get at. But what we say to our members is this. If you told customers what you were doing, and a substantial number of them would leave you when they found that out, either don't do it, or tell them and provide them an opt-out. And the same thing would apply in this example, too. If, in fact, because of a new merger, you have a new affiliate structure, and so the information would be flowing to companies that they would be surprised at and would leave you if they knew otherwise, then you should disclose it, and you should provide that opt-out. Yes.
Jean, what's your?
Well, we believe that consumers should be given the opportunity to consent to affiliate sharing of information, and that's one of the major weaknesses in the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, that consumers do not have control over the sharing of personal financial information within the affiliates of a financial company. And consumers don't know who the affiliate is. These companies have merged so many times and have gotten so big that you don't have any realistic way of knowing who the affiliates are. They don't have the same names. You don't know that. I think that you need to have clear law and rules on this, and it does work. The Center for Media Education released a report last Thursday on the first year of compliance with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and they are finding that companies are changing the way they collect information and are beginning to comply with the law. So you can have law that applies here. We think the important thing is that states be allowed to enact stronger law. That's the way we do it in this country. We have federal law that sets a minimum standard, and we hope the attorneys general will support federal legislation that allows the states to enact stronger law, the same as they did with Graham-Leach-Bliley. I know it's a tough road to hoe. I lobby at the state level. Back when Ms. Terry and I used to hang out in Richmond together, and it's tough to beat these guys at the state level. But once you give up your right to have stronger state law, you throw one of your bargaining chips out the window. We hope you won't do that.
Jill, what's your view? You're now part of Citigroup.
I'm big, aren't I? I actually think I agree with Mallory on this one, which is that it depends on what you said to your customers, depends on what your customers' expectations are and the situation. So in your hypothetical where you're talking about Aetna, you're talking about healthcare, I can tell you, having worked within AOL, in order to launch our health areas on AOL, we moved to an opt-in model in the health area because we sort of examined the marketplace, talked to our consumers through focus groups and said, well, gee, here's an obvious area where consumers are concerned and the information is sensitive, and let's go for opt-in. So I probably would come out differently in the Aetna case than Mallory did in terms of opt-out versus opt-in, but I think as a general matter, you have to look at the notice you gave to your consumers what they deserve. And frankly, you know, in big companies, you have a lot of research. You know whether your consumers will stand for one thing or another, think it's a good thing, stay with you, lose respect for you, gain respect for you based on what you did. And particularly in this day and age where brand loyalty is not something you can count on over the long haul, and we're all very focused on it, particularly at a media company like AOL Time Warner, you know, we would probably err on the side of giving more notice and more choice.
We only have a couple minutes. If there are questions here, throw up your hand. Otherwise, let me ask, you know, get to you in 1 second. Let me just ask one last question and make it quick so we can get to the few questions that are out here. Let's say a company willfully violates its privacy policy. It says, you know what, we're on the verge of bankruptcy. We're teetering. We've got to increase our sales. We're going to sell this information to XYZ marketing company. We know we will get an extra, you know, $500 million cash flow, and we need it to pay our bonds. What's the sanction?
Fraud.
So you do criminal charges?
I think it's fraudulent to collect information on one set of promises and to sell it. Necessity isn't an excuse, is it?
I wouldn't say so. Mallory, let's say, come on, defend your...
I would actually agree with Gene on this. If the company says never, then never means never, and they shouldn't have.
So the next time you want to go after one of your clients, you're going to tell them you gave it to the okay.
If they say never.
All right.
But people tell them never to say
never.
They
never say never. All right.
Never.
Who's got a question? Did you? Yes, sir.
I mean, I think the answer is yes, that privacy policy should be as detailed as they can be without overwhelming consumers. So, and it's a balancing act. It's sort of hard to put your finger on. We had this experience. I was testifying in the Senate a couple of years ago on this issue, and Senator McCain held up Yahoo's privacy policy, claiming that, you know, who could understand an 11-page privacy policy? And the defense that Yahoo gave was, you know, our lawyers are sort of running scared about whether or not they're ultimately going to be fraudulent, so they've put, you know, sort of everything under the sun, which becomes completely unuseful to consumers. So I think, as a matter of good business practices, what we do and what I think a lot of companies do is sort of figure out what the categories are. So do we track purchases?
Yeah.
You don't have to sort of get into the level of detail that you talked to, or do we track where you go online, or, you know, what kinds of information, types of information do we collect in what kinds of circumstances? And then you've got a situation where you really are conversing with consumers, you're not overwhelming them, but you're also not leaving out the details so that they're otherwise confused.
But of course, if they minimize the data collection to what they actually need to fulfill your order, do business with you, there's less to disclose.
Well, let me just end, as you know, the clock runs. Let me end with a yes or no question for each of you. Don't we live right now in the world that Gene described, where from 50 years ago, if somebody were walking behind you as you went through the store and were making notations about everything you looked at, picked up, examined, you'd hit them over the head with your umbrella? Don't we live in that world right now?
Mm-hmm.
Just from online, that's right.
Well, I think online people have a higher expectation that is being done, and that's why I think you need some rules and regulations in the online world that perhaps may not always fall over into the offline world. As they converge, they need to get here closer and closer. But I think the online world is something that we can still get the parameters around. I think we can try to develop some consumer-friendly law in that area, and then where we can, let's move into the offline world.
Mallory?
A little more complicated than that. 50 years ago, we lived in small towns where everyone knew all of our business. They may not have followed us around, but there was a gossip circle.
You did grow up in New York City.
No. There was a gossip circle that essentially told everything about us. We've now lived much more anonymous lives, and we've become accustomed to that anonymity. In fact, the amount of information that's being gathered now is taking us to some extent back to where we were 50 years ago.
I think we live in the wild west of data collection about individual consumers. I think it undermines consumer confidence in electronic commerce. And I believe that we need effective protection if everybody's going to succeed together.
Jill?
I disagree. I think 3 years ago we lived in the Wild West. I think now you'd be hard-pressed to find a website operating it with any degree of success that does not have a privacy policy and isn't trying to communicate with its consumers about its use of information.
Isn't that great? We got a consensus at the end. All right. Is it lunchtime? Bill says go to lunch. All right. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
People can take their seats, and for those of you that are viewing this via webcast, welcome to our webcast viewers to the first ever NAG webcast internet conference. I think we've had a very interesting morning, a provocative lunch session. For those of you that don't know, I am not Christine Gregoire. I am the Janet Napolitano, the Attorney General of Arizona, and I've been asked to moderate this panel in Christine's absence. She has been required to stay in her state, something about all the state employees striking or walking off their job or something serious like that. So she's dealing with issues in the state of Washington, and we will deal here with issues involving the internet and the law and the internet. We are privileged to have quite a distinguished panel here for this first session of the afternoon. And before I kick us off with some questions, I'd like to just go down the row and have each of them introduce themselves and something about themselves. Susan?
My name is Susan Pender, and I'm manager of government relations with General Electric Company. I'm a tax lawyer by background, and you might all ask yourselves how it is that a tax lawyer gets involved in privacy, and that would take up the entire panel to answer. But I will tell you that the parallels between privacy and tax law are incredible. First of all, everyone has a story about privacy. It's very personal and about taxes. And secondly, and I think more importantly, the devil is in the details in both areas. I work for, as I said, for General Electric, a very large and complicated global company. I also sit as the chair of a coalition of about 20 global companies, more Main Street, Wall Street, I guess, is the best way to describe this, but cross-sectoral group. And so we try to look at privacy from a very holistic standpoint, from the standpoint of retail, financial services, insurance, and all across the board, and see the need to somehow try to integrate all of the different elements of privacy policy. It's important to my company. It's also important to the member companies that I work with.
Thank you, Susan. If privacy policies end up like the tax code, we'll be sure that nobody will understand them. Mike?
Hi, my name is Mike Baker. I'm EVP and General Counsel for Engage, a company here in Massachusetts. Engage is an advertising company, an internet advertising company that's affiliated with CMGI, the internet investment company. Engage, just real briefly, so you appreciate my background, is essentially a broker of advertising. And what I mean by that is we aggregate advertising inventory, spaces, holes on web pages, from sellers, and this would be some over 4,000 websites. We aggregate all of that, and then we find buyers, Procter & Gamble or whomever, to place the banner ads in the holes on pages. So we really are a broker of online media, and I think in that role have a good perspective of sort of what's happening in the marketplace and, you know, whether ad-supported business models can sustain themselves and continue to provide content free of charge, as well as, you know, why business is keen to collect data to profile and otherwise try to increase the value of advertising inventory.
Paula? I am Paula Breening. I'm staff counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology. CDT is an independent nonprofit public interest group that advocates free expression. And